You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 483 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in different locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West leading Seattle Mariners.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the NFC West participating. NFC West point differential, DVOA champion.
Thank you. DVOA leading Seattle Seahawks.
Seattle Seahawks. I almost said Mariners.
If they, you know what, FanGraphs, if they had a DVOA, Mariners might be leading that one too.
Hello.
I love them some Mariners.
That is plus 30 in point differential.
Well, I mean, yeah, can't complain. What a weekend.
What a weekend.
It's almost like we just recorded something recapping the weekend. Did you want to hear until the end of this podcast?
We didn't, really. What a weekend, though, in Seattle sports. And that's going to be it. No more weekends after this.
Yeah, we should just call
it off. It does not get more difficult from here.
Do we want to pull a George and just very
head
fitting,
out.
Giving the Mariners what the Mariners did to Jason Alexander?
Oh,
on Sunday
I loved
night.
It. I loved it.
He did not leave on a high note, alas.
It was a pitching performance about nothing.
Well, one of the things that happened in that performance, in that Jason Alexander start, was a home run. And we begin our toast this week with congratulations to Cal Raleigh, who on Saturday set the Mariners' single-season home record with his 57th in Houston before resetting it on
Hello.
Sunday with his 58th off of Jason Alexander.
Home run record. Not a home record.
Did I say that?
Yeah. Cal Raleigh is really good at baseball.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the hot takes you come to this podcast
yes.
for about the Mariners.
Yes. Cal Raleigh, big fan. big fan of his.
I like the Seattle Times had like the case for Cal Raleigh for MVP as if like they needed to win people over. I would really like be more impressed with
Seattle. Out an ad in the New York Times. Don't worry about the Seattle Times, dog.
I would be more impressed if the Seattle Times did the case for Aaron Judge opposite the case for Cal Raleigh. That would be interesting. That I'm reading. I mean, I get it. They're probably breaking down the stats.
I'm not reading any of it.
But yeah, so you have tickets for Wednesday night.
Yes, sir.
Correct.
Yes, I do.
There is a chance that Cal Raleigh hits a milestone home run in this game.
I can't wait. I mean, that's the fun part about this time season. What do you think the chances are, by the way, I want to say, for that game on Wednesday that the Mariners clinch a playoff spot?
In that game?
Game two of the Rockies series. Isn't there magic number two right now?
Their magic number is two, but it's a combination of Mariners wins and Yankees wins.
So I kind of want, for the stakes, I mean, they are at 100% in FanGraphs playoff odds right now. So feeling pretty good.
That makes me a little nervous.
Everything that we do is the most Mariners shit of all time.
You remember the 2022? Like, that's why, like, you know, they clinched with a full series left plus two games in the series that they were playing. Like, there was five games left in the season, right? When Cal Raleigh hit the home run.
That sounds right. Yeah, it's like the previous like weekend or something.
And yet we were so tense that somehow the Mariners were going to blow it. That's why that Cal Raleigh home run was so important, because we were convinced the Mariners were going
to. It also sent them to the playoffs. It would have been important either way. There's just so much.
That's what I'm saying.
It's
they didn't send them to the playoffs on the last day of the season. It wasn't like, oh, if he doesn't hit this home run, they're not going to the playoffs. They probably were going to the playoffs either way. The other team, whoever, I don't remember who was in contention for the wild card at that point, was probably going to lose. And yet, because they ended up the fifth wild card, there was, you know, they were the fifth seed. And yet, it was still such a stress relief to have Cal Raleigh hit that home run. Also, the other thing non-Husky fans can't realize is the excitement of him doing that while the Huskies were losing at UCLA to offset. You were so depressed when Cal Raleigh hit that home run. Great memories.
That is really funny.
I had forgotten about that.
Yeah, no, I was the most dead on the inside.
You didn't realize that you were watching Seahawks legends Jake Bobo and Zach Charbonnet on that particular Friday night. And I didn't realize, well, I don't know, something about the Clippers I was watching in that game.
We were all really on brand that day.
Oh, we only have one brand. Gotta stick to it.
I somebody, you know the phrase "who hurt you" that people say sometimes?
Yes.
The Mariners fans. I know who hurt you. This is like Oil Tannenbaum's. He did. Like, we've been hurt by the Mariners, so I get it. But there is a little bit of like, this is the most Mariners shit of all time. Anyway, I would be very excited to be at a
so
game.
So you're saying you hope the Yankees win on Tuesday and the
kind
Mariners
of, yes.
also win?
Yes, for myself, which is really who it's all for.
So, I mean, I don't know. The magic number to win, again, the division, the playoffs is 2, assuming that one of those is a Yankees loss or 2 Mariners wins. The magic number to win the AL West is 3. The magic number to clinch the number 2 seed in the AL is 4.
Okay.
So things are happening.
Things
are
happening.
Things are moving fast. We'll talk more about that in the hot takes. Let's continue twisting to the weekend with a congrats to Big Ten co-offensive player of the week, Damond Williams Jr., the third time in as many weeks that the Huskies have played a game that they have shared co-offensive player of the week honors in the Big Ten. Sadly, did not win this award when they had a bye in week 3. Damond Williams Jr. in the Apple Cup, 99.3 QBR, completed 16 of 19 passes for 298 yards and 4 touchdowns in Pullman, added 88 yards and a touchdown on the ground. This was truly, like, it's not going to go down given the stakes and this and the time of the season with, like, you know, the Marcus Tuiasosopo 300-200 game, Jake Browning at Oregon, etc. Much older games that I can't think of off the top of my head. But this was legitimately one of the greatest performances in UW quarterback history.
Do you want to know why it's kind of crazy?
Why?
He just kind of casually did that shit.
Right? Did.
Like, they scored 59 points on Wazoo. I get it. It's probably a down Wazoo season. But, like,
I think it is very likely a down, was certainly defensively a down season.
He was 19 attempts for almost 300 yards with 4 touchdowns and then 7 yards per carry, which includes sacks.
Right. It was 110 if you take out the sacks. He was nearly 300-100 without that.
And he did it casually. That is the thing about Damond Williams that I feel like people aren't really recognizing. It wasn't like, whoa, Damond's playing out of his mind. It was like, yeah, Damond's having a nice game.
Oh, well. Yeah.
That was really it. Like, he played a good game. But the other crazy thing about Damond is, I swear to God, this is my favorite athlete that has ever existed. But the crazy thing about Damond is that you look up and you're like, has he thrown an incompletion? Like, the 16 for 19, there has never been a quarterback on the face of the earth who does what Damond Williams does. Not one. He is the greatest quarterback to have ever walked the planet.
Don't be for Tom Brady.
There might be things. Tom Brady ran for 100 yards? Come on. How many seasons would it take for Tom Brady to run for 100 yards in a game? Get the hell out of here. But, like, that's a lot of quarterback sneaks. That Damond could pair the deep passing ability with the completion percentage and the running, literally, there is not a thing he cannot do. Again, all of the shit that we're talking about, baseball, Seahawks number 1 in DVOA, like Mariners chance in the number 2 seed, the only thing I care about is a chance to see Damond Williams against Ohio State.
That's a bold take.
It is truly, like, it just from a fascination perspective, the ability to see him going against, I mean, he's played against Oregon's defense last year, Penn State last year, both of those on the road, both of those with that offensive line. And he still did awesome in both of those games. So bringing him back here against the number 1 team in the country with more experience, he already is in unprecedented territory right now. And that was start, like, number 5.
Yeah.
Maybe. Right? His first start was.
Yeah,
Oregon,
2 last year.
It?
2 last year, 3 this year. Yeah.
So, it is wild what he does and that he can do that. And we are just so, like, blasé about it.
It is true. It was amusing. There was a lot of talk on the broadcast on CBS about this being his national coming out party, which I think overstated the level of interest in a game between Washington and Washington State at the in the 4:30 window
I will
on
say I don't know how
before
much
the
the
season.
Xfinity, the quad box that that Xfinity does is national or if it's tailored to here, but
But
it
you'd
was
have
one
made
of the
it.
four games.
I mean, he did play on CBS previously in the Sun Bowl and had a truly amazing game in that one. But I do think people are like so accustomed now to discounting bowl performances that there was a legitimacy to it. But let's be clear. If he has a very good game on Saturday against Ohio State and the Huskies are competitive in that game, that also on CBS will be his national coming out party.
What they will have to do after that game is, are there any UW branded semis? I feel like there must be, right? They're going to have to load them up with money and bring them to Damon Williams. Because the amount of money that Damon Williams is making right now is a lot. Like, that is the only thing where I'm just like, I love Damon Williams so unequivocally. And the thing that I hate about college football is that I'm all like, I know how people are worried about Florida and stuff and a particular coach. But I'm like, just please, dear God, I cannot see Damon play for any other team. It will be like, it'll be the most crushing thing. It'll be like watching Kevin Durant play for that other team.
At least we'd have a team. I mean, I will say that, let's put it this way, Jed Fish, that coach you're talking about, does not hesitate to gas him up. So he doesn't seem worried about the budget.
Oh, I think they're gonna find it. They are going to he. Again, if he continues, he'll be the highest paid college football quarterback of all
Either
time.
that or Jed Fish is going to convinced he's going to have the Florida budget. All right, congrats to Torrey Horton, who joined Bobby Engram and Joey Galloway, is the third player in Seahawks history with a punt return touchdown and a receiving touchdown in the same game. He did it, to use your Damon Williams comment, in his third NFL
Game
game.
three. That was awesome.
Torrey Horton might be really like, I spent a lot of the morning, I think it was partially for fantasy purposes, being frustrated about Emeka Egbuka and how much success he was having for Tampa Bay.
He like had a fine game, six catches for 85 yards. It was like not a great fantasy game.
No, not, I mean, I don't think I was playing against him. I think it was just like I was going, it was something about the Tampa Bay offense as a whole.
I'm talking about that fantasy wise. It was a
Yeah,
fine game.
but like NFL week three rookie receiver, Emeka Egbuka is so good, and being upset that the Seahawks didn't draft him. And then in the afternoon, I came around to that was actually the best thing that could have happened, much like the Jamal Adams trade led to the Russell Wilson trade. Not drafting Emeka Egbuka allowed the Seahawks to draft Torrey Horton.
Now, I don't know. Damon Williams is the greatest quarterback that has ever walked the face of the earth. But there is another. His name is Sam Darnold.
Oh, NFL PFF grades leader.
14 of 18 for 218 yards, plus the escapability of Sam Darnold. Like he looked like he was going to go down on that play, rolls out, escapes it. Bam, hits the big pass to JSN. I'm like, it was very Damon-like. Many people were saying the pass that Damon hit to Jonah the night before. They were like, wow, Sam Darnold has Damon Williams-like escapability.
Seahawks and Huskies both on CBS, a very unusual weekend. I don't know when the last time is that it happened. The UW football information account did post that this will be the first UW home game on CBS since 1986.
Here's what
So
somebody
it's
should
been a
look
minute.
up. How many years has it been since both teams successfully hit fade routes for touchdowns?
That's a
Infinite.
that's a, an amazing question. By the way, I should also note we didn't. I didn't mention this. I thought about it. Michael Penix Jr. against Texas in the college football playoff semifinal. I'm going to nominate that one as one of the great, quarterback performances of all time. Just going to throw that out there.
Didn't run for 100 yards.
I know they all pale in comparison to Damon Williams Jr., but that deserves
I
to
mean,
be
they
mentioned.
had, I think his QBR is probably better. Is QBR's opponent adjusted or?
QBR is opponent adjusted. I don't know if it was better, though. I don't know if Michael Penix Jr. ever had.
He did, I'm sure. Hold on.
I don't know if you can you still get these? Okay, you
Yeah.
can still get these. No, I.
Was 99.3, wasn't it?
Yes. Okay, so Penix's QBR in that game was 97.7, and
poultry.
His season high. Let's see if he had anything better in 2022.
Also, that is very wild to have a season high in the college football playoff.
I mean, his 2022 high was 96.3 in the Apple Cup. So yes, that was better QBR than any game in Michael Penix Jr.'s game. So one thing I didn't realize until
went out there and did that
casually. One thing I didn't understand until I was reading Nate Silver's explanation of his QB metric in the NFL is that QBR is actually calibrated. So it's like the percentage of games you were better than, hypothetically. So going from like 98th percentile to 99th percentile in standard deviation terms is a bigger deal than going from like a 98 on the quarterback rating to a 99, if that makes sense. Once you get out to those extreme ends of the tail of the distribution.
So that was his best QBR game. Well, Iowa. I mean, yeah, he's 99.1 against Iowa.
Well, I mean, how many attempts was that, though?
16. It wasn't nothing.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He ran very well. Like, he had, I don't know. We know 16 for 71 yards.
We know that QBR loves the rushing, but
he didn't run that much, though. It's only 3 carries for 23 yards. He just didn't gain a ton of yards on the completions, but for some reason, QBR really liked it.
DeMond is number 2 nationally in QBR behind Jaden Maiava from USC. So
it looks really good.
I'm noting a distinct lack of John Mateer anywhere in the top 35.
Really?
Yeah, he's 36. Your guy Dante Moore is 13th, though. He's pretty good.
My John Mateer sucks takes are... I thought I had to give up on those takes because they've looked pretty good, but...
I mean, Oklahoma has undoubtedly looked pretty good.
QBR, don't lie.
And
QBR,
that's even with...
That's
illegal.
A win,
did you see the illegal play Oklahoma ran for a touchdown?
No, what was that?
They had the guy sneak off and pretend that he was going to the sideline and wait on the edge of the field, which you're not allowed to do. You have to go back inside the number.
Mm.
And the SEC officials just missed it.
That a team from Oklahoma, the Sooners, would run an illegal play.
Well, they might cheat. All right. Last up on our toast. This is not specifically to this weekend, but a congrats to the Storm's NECA of Ogwumike, who received the Kim Perot Sportsmanship Award on Monday for the fourth time in her career. She previously won it every year from 2019 through 2021 while playing for the Los Angeles Sparks, and now surpasses Sue Bird as the most frequent recipient of this award. So kudos to NECA. All right, with that, it is time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
I'm going to do a short take this week because it's a precipice week. It's an eve right now for the Seattle Mariners. And I want to talk about trust. And trust in your Pelton Cast MVP, who way back in April 2025 told you, the haters, and the haters specifically known as ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton, to trust in the Seattle Mariners roster that had absolutely no holes. Discussed on this take was future Mariners, Donnie Barrels, Rowdy Tellez, a 40 home run season for Mitch Garver, a 30 home run season for Jorge Polanco, and how great the pitching staff is. And that's because the MVP sees all, is what I'm trying to say. Can you re-air that take from the beginning of the season? I was so hyped listening to it. I don't want to say anything before the Mariners have clinched anything yet, though. Hello! And welcome to regular season Mariners Hot Takes. It has been a long one, folks. From the narrow miss that was the 2024 season to now, we have spent 4 arduous, frigid, anxiety-filled, bad news, no good in this world kind of months. But guess what? It won't fix all or maybe even any of our problems. But baseball is back. And Seattle showed up today for it. 70 degrees and 90 feet is all we need. Now, these months have been long as well, because we have endured nonstop, around the clock, complaining from fans and foes alike about this team. But I ask you, would you give notes to perfection? Would you tell Basquiat to stay within the lines? Would you tell Airplane, hey, maybe less jokes? Would you tell Gary Payton to throw less alley-oops to Sean Kemp? Well, then why are you telling a perfect roster to be better? Inarguably the most fun, if not the best outfield in baseball, heading into a bounce back season for Julio. I think you could safely lock him in for AL MVP at least. A now locked in big
what
number.
Else would be better than that?
There are records to be broken, thank you. A now locked in big dumper. You'll be seeing that derriere until at least 2031. Speaking of bounce backs, strap yourself in for a 40 homer season for Mitch Garver and a 30 homer season from Jorge Polanco, who I kind of forgot was on the team until now. All that, plus a scrappy infield with soon to be fan favorite Donnie Barrels, Ryan Bliss, and of course, sorry, Mitch, but things in Seattle are about to get rowdy. Marine layer, what? Speaking of those haters, we have one of them here on this very podcast. A person who cannot see true greatness right in front of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 aces on one rotation. You better believe I'm including Emerson Hancock. Each pitcher better than the last. Somehow the two best starters on the rotation are the two newest. I'd predict a Cy Young winner, but I can't tell who's going to have the best season. They may not give up a run all year with the staff. And the thing about the Mariners is they love the fastball. That's where it starts with this team, with their rotation. And the last piece they're missing is a great nickname, which is why you've seen the Bash Brothers in the AL West. And just up north, the Mariners have the Gas Brothers, which is what I'm going to be calling the six starters full of heat. Watch your motherfucking back, American League. Couple that with a full season of the 95 spirit from Thunder Dan Wilson, and a pennant isn't enough, because this roster is, say it with me.
Oh, no. Oh, no. He's doing the thing.
No holes. Whew, I'm ready for baseball.
Nailed it. I mean,
you haven't re-listened, but wait till you re-listen and then come tell me that I nailed it.
The wild thing is the no holes thing is spreading like wildfire. Four aces is out there, even though kind of a questionable time for the four. But this last week or
four
two,
aces out there. Does anybody not remember six aces?
Well, Logan Evans has to get healthy. He's still working his way back. One inning on Tuesday. I don't know if he pitched on Sunday. I guess that would have been his next rehab stint.
My favorite thing about that, I went and looked at the this is a thanks AI moment. At the Spotify of it, and it has descriptions under of what we're talking about that I guess you don't put in there. I thought you did, but it's like Spotify AI breaks down what we're talking about. And the Mariners signed, it was like the first segment, Kyle Rally. K-Y-L-E-R-A-L-L-E-Y. And I literally was like, who is this person that the Mariners signed that we were talking about? I was like, I don't even remember that guy. So, thanks, AI.
I don't know about this, but...
You should go look at it on Spotify. They have it broken down in the segments.
I will have to go check it out.
Seattle Mariners.
Do you think he might win MVP?
Kyle?
Yeah.
The bullpen. I'm just looking at what the segments are called. Most of them are... I'm sure we were talking about the bullpen there. Taco Burger Returns. Because it was a Mariners season preview / Talking Taco. It might have been the last Talking Taco. Have we done one since then?
We have done a Talking Taco time since then. You haven't done a Talking Taco time since then because
I don't even
think
I've been to Taco time since then. But no holes on this roster. The thing that really struck me about this series against the Astros is that I just knew it was coming. Honestly, I was so nonplussed the entire weekend. And the Mariners kind of did it. It is
funny. Jay Buhner was like talking a lot about how stressful like baseball this time of year is. And it's partially because, look, my level of investment at the Mariners is ultimately not as significant as my level of investment in other Seattle sports teams where
it's just they weren't stressful games.
I never pace. But yeah, they took early leads in every game, including a 7-0 lead in the second last night. It was actually kind of perfect to like not check out on these, certainly, but like more of the attention went to the Apple Cup because of the fact that the Mariners were leading comfortably. Now, needed to tune back in for the amazing Victor Robles catch to end the threat against Andres Munoz in the ninth on Saturday. But yeah, it was about as unstressful a set of games as you could possibly have. And what struck me about it, I would say, is how it was the complete fucking opposite of 2023.
It's
when the Mariners
a different
went to
team.
Texas and Houston at the end of the season.
This is a different team. They are a better team now. This is the team that we expected to happen. And I'll probably take a victory lap in a week or so. I mean, we'll be previewing the playoffs most likely in a week. But like,
I mean, we'll have to be previewing the playoffs. This is the time where we know that that will be the final Pelton cast until
I don't think we'll have to be previewing the playoffs because they've not clinched the playoffs.
Fine, as you point out. Yes.
But it reminded me, so like they had that stretch, the swoon that they had where they lost the 3 to Atlanta and then they lost, or the 3 to Tampa Bay, and they played bad against Cleveland. And every time I'd pull my phone, it'd be like, the Mariners are already down. You know what yeah. I mean? And like literally it'd be the first inning. I'm just like, what the hell? How are they already down in this game? It was the exact opposite of that. Every time I would be like distracted by something and I'd be like, oh, the Mariners are up 2-0.
See, the Mariners game started before everything else. I was watching the WNBA game 3 on Friday and then the Apple Cup on Saturday. So I was locked into the start of the games. Very much so. Sunday was a little tougher timing-wise, but was there for the second inning. It was great. The one bad thing that happened, Brian Wu left after 5 terrific innings and really, I would say, gave us a tremendous scare. You know, pulling himself out after his warm-up pitches in a period where he had gone 5 innings allowing 1 hit and one walk and striking out 7. But the news ultimately was about as good as it possibly could be. Testing revealed minor inflammation in his pectoral muscle, is not expected to hit the injured list, and has not even yet been ruled out for his final start of the regular season, which is scheduled on Thursday. Now, it would be great if the Mariners had clinched a bunch of stuff by Thursday and didn't need to worry about it, but Either way, seems hopeful for the chances of Brian Wu being able to pitch in the playoffs, which is important because if you're doing an aces list, Brian Wu is near the top of it, if not at the top of it.
It's also one of the important pieces about getting the number 2 seed is adding those extra few days.
Correct.
To not have to play baseball. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but getting the 2 seed.
I mean, you to set up your rotation for the ALDS. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about the Mariners and the playoffs, like it's always been like, imagine these starters in the playoffs in a series to be able to just slot it in for them and not have to worry about like going and winning these, like they're like overtime hockey games, right? If you're in the play-in games at that point, like those games are very stressful to have happen. But if they can set it up just for the ALDS, know that they're in a 5-game series, know that they're going to have home field advantage for it, it would be a real privilege for the Mariners to be in that situation. They'd be on the fast track to the ALCS.
Yep. They'd be. I mean, look, playoff baseball is very random. We'll talk about this hopefully more next week, but all you can do is try to set yourself up to be in good position when you get there. And the Mariners are on the cusp of doing that. They have the chance to do that. They have given themselves that opportunity.
And I think this win streak, and granted it's happened at the end of the season, I think people struggle with, this is a Kevin Pelton thing, in fact, people view things too much as like, oh, well, it took that thing to get there. And it's like, well, they did that thing. So like, this is not a demerit to the season that it took this win streak at the end of the season to get where their record should be, because they've won those games. And but there are a lot of teams that have
around at the AL, like the Yankees and the Red Sox have triple-digit run differentials. You know, those teams are not going to win their division. The Mariners now have a better run differential than the Blue Jays, who will likely be the number one seed. And they're even, essentially, with the Tigers. Now, the one team they still haven't got, Texas Rangers, plus 82.
Whatever. We will let the Rangers have it. But you understand what I'm saying? Where people are like, oh, well, they needed that win streak to get to the place their record is. It's like, yeah, they won those games. And I will tell you who didn't, and it's a lot of teams across the AL. And it's not like they were all playing crazy great schedules. Like, there were teams in the AL who were losing to bad teams. So, and they went into Houston and just casually swept them, right? The only sweat that there was a little tiny bit on Saturday night. And the Robles catch, obviously, like, have to give credit to Robles coming appearing out of nowhere to make that catch. I was skeptical about Victor Robles, but I think the Mariners even handled, and you do have to kind of note where his return from suspension came and where that swoon happened. Like, Victor Robles matters.
Well, I mean, they were playing with like a 24-man roster instead of a 26-man roster because they not only had Robles suspended, they still had Donovan Solano on the team.
What was... Oh, I remember him. He was just in the take a second ago.
He was, yeah.
He's a Mariner favorite. fan favorite. Things are about to get rowdy. don't worry about it. What day did he return from suspension?
He returned suspension on September 6th. The Mariners subsequently won their
next. They have lost one game since Robles returned from suspension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously, it's not necessarily all about him, but like...
And they won the two games, or they won three of the four after they called him back up that he appeared in. So he's only appeared in two losses since April 6th.
Wow. Is Victor Robles the most important Mariner? We need to do the Victor Robles versus Ichiro. He's going to crush Ichiro record-wise, right?
They are 20-9. Let me do the math on that one. I assume so, but...
They're 20-9 with Robles for the season because they started a little slow.
Yeah, they're still behind the Ichiro pace. They'd need to win a few more.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Oh, because it was game two in San Francisco.
If they swept the series against Colorado, they would be ahead of Ichiro.
Oh my god! I like that we just say it
because of the fact that Ichiro is in the headshot. If it was the 2001 Mariners, they would be ahead of 2001 Mariners pace with Victor Robles in games he's appeared in.
Hello,
they sweep the Rockies, and he appears in all three games. So
this is huge. This is important information that we need to be tracking. Right now,
I've got another tracker I'm planning on working on. I didn't have time to get it in before the pod. I mean,
can you say what that tracker is?
We'll get to the second half of this later, but it involves two Seattle sports teams whose fortunes tend to often swing in opposite directions.
Okay,
fair
enough.
Never both made the playoffs in the same year in the history of the franchises.
It's the Sounders and the Mariners?
It is, yes.
Okay. Wow. We say Ichiro because like it's the funniest that it's the argument that he's better than Ichiro.
Yes. But it also does give Ichiro the entire credit for the 2001 season.
Yeah, he can have all credit for the entire 2001 playoffs. Would you guess?
I'm not going to lose if Mark Andrews scores a touchdown. This is getting very stressful for me.
There were thousands of jerseys at the Seahawks game yesterday and a number 51 jersey. And who do you think that number 51 jersey was of?
Bruce Irvin.
No, not Bruce Irvin.
I mean, I assume if it's Ichiro, that's like too obvious.
It is Ichiro. An Ichiro Seahawks jersey. And were that I to know the person.
Wait, really?
John Fraley has an Ichiro Seahawks jersey. He popped over into our section and he has like a friend who sits like the section over from us. And Chris is like, Ichiro Seahawks jersey. And I'm like, yeah.
I
would know the person with an Ichiro Seahawks jersey.
Ichiro, come on the pod. Anything else on the Mariners?
Victor Robles is better than Ichiro.
Not yet.
Victor Robles might be better than Ichiro.
Could be better than Ichiro. All right, let's get into the roundup quickly. Seattle Kraken.
Just even saying like the number two seed, though.
Usually when I say the anything more to add, that's when you add the anything more, not after I've started into the roundup.
The number two seed being so hugely important for Seattle. I mean, like if the Mariners... I think the most important Seattle baseball event since 2001 would be the Mariners, those four games, the four-game magic number, right? For the number two seed. Because making the playoffs two seasons ago was nice, but like, if they're in the two seed, the Mariners, with a very fraudulent number one seed in the American League, there is a... FanGraphs has told us. There is a very large percentage chance of them making the World Series. So that is...
Mark Andrews got the touchdown.
Did he really?
This is brutal.
I got to pull up my team. That's another passing touchdown for Lamar.
Yeah.
Let's work it to Jahmyr Gibbs a lot now.
All right, roundup time. Kraken opened the preseason Sunday with a 5-3 win over the Vancouver Canucks. Yanni Newman, a former second-rounder looking to make the NHL roster after playing most of last season at Coachella Valley, had 2 goals, while Vince Dunn and Kaapo Kakko both had multiple assists. As usual, the Kraken will face the Canucks, Calgary Flames, and Edmonton Oilers, both home and away in the preseason, including back-to-back at Calgary and Edmonton Tuesday and Wednesday. Seattle Sounders. If the Mariners are up, you know the even Steven. Sounders must be down a 2-1 loss Sunday at Austin FC. Sounders conceded in the 42nd minute on the brink of halftime. Then we're feeling good because Georgi Manungu came on at halftime for Schneider Brunel and scored seconds later, like the best possible sub. Despite the Sounders having the better of the opportunities, team seemed to be headed for an inevitable draw before Austin improbably scored in the 96th minute to drop the Sounders to 1 point in their 3 matches over the last 9 days, including a pair of outright losses. The Sounders have fallen now to 5th in the Western Conference standings, 1 point ahead of Austin, 3 ahead of Portland. They do still have a 6-point cushion on avoiding the play-in for the Western Conference playoffs and a match in hand on that team in 8th. So they're probably not going to miss the playoffs, even if the Mariners make it. But can we rule it out? We cannot rule it out. The good news, such as it is, last Tuesday at Miami was their last midweek game, so they're not going to have another of these busy stretches. The Sounders will now play every Saturday for the remaining 4 weeks of the regular season, including the Cascadia's Cup skirmishes the next 2 weeks. On Saturday, they host the Vancouver, or they visit the Vancouver Whitecaps. They got to host that, right? Who are still in the mix for the Supporters' Shield right now.
And just a great decision by the MLS to just have that season extend straight into Saturdays against no other popular sports in the United States of America.
Well, they are reconsidering that one.
Okay. Yeah. Did I call that?
Probably. They are hosting Vancouver. I don't know why I wrote that down wrong in the notes. The Whitecaps still in the mix for the Supporters' Shield, 5 points back of Philadelphia with 2 matches in hand. Vancouver 2 points behind San Diego in the West, but tops in points per match thanks to those matches in hand. So this is going to be a tough one for the Sounders to get full points, but important at least for them to get a result and stop this slide a little bit. Seattle Reign FC were never really competitive against the NWSL's top team on Saturday as the Kansas City Current clinched the NWSL Shield, outshooting the Reign 8-1. Dabinia converted a PK in the 34th minute to give the Current the lead, which they doubled in the 74th minute through Temwa Chiwenga, who headed home a rebound. The worst news here, during her second start, Mia Fischel left with an ankle injury that coach Laura Harvey suggested postgame could cause her to miss multiple weeks. Reign are still 6th in the NWSL standings, now 1 point back of a logjam for 3rd, and with a 4-point cushion for a playoff spot with 5 matches remaining. It's a crucial matchup Sunday as they host the North Carolina Courage, who are 2 points back in 8th. Seattle Storm, it feels like forever ago now. We have not recorded since their season ended against the Las Vegas Aces. Game 3 in Vegas, a thriller that came down to the final possession for the Storm. Erica Wheeler had a pull-up jumper that would have very likely sent them on through to the semifinals. It's off under the Asia Wilson contest. Storm got the offensive rebound, but Gabby Williams was unable to get a shot off before the lights inexplicably went out right at the buzzer.
That doesn't happen every game.
I don't know if it's happens in Vegas in general, but it's not supposed to happen that fast that you don't even see whether the shot goes in or not.
It seems like a really bad idea.
Which it didn't, and it wouldn't have counted anyway. But I felt for Gabby Williams, who had a shot last year in the gold medal game against the U.S. that would have tied it if it had been a 3, but her foot was on the line or she was inside the line, so it was a 2. So she's been in this situation entirely too much through no particular fault of her own. Like, on some level, an impressive battle by the Storm, but also sort of the reminder of why you don't want to be the 7th seed and face the Aces in the first round. So
I think the playoffs went, if you were me and had my perception of this team, knowing the information we know now, I think the playoffs went about as perfectly as they could go for the Storm.
It is kind of funny. I was looking back on my like preseason capsule on the Storm for something else. And I said that making the semifinals was probably too much for them to expect, but that they could feel really good if they had a hard-fought first-round playoff series and got a lottery pick from the Sparks.
Wow, the MVP says you're welcome.
I did kind of nail it on that one. So what you're alluding to, obviously, is the part two of this, which on Sunday, the Storm announced that Noelle Quinn will not be returning as head coach. She was in the last season of her contract, will not get a new one. The Storm also let their assistant coaches, who were presumably also in the last year of their contracts, go, and will be searching for a new head coach in 2026.
But so that's definitely part of it. I mean, I wonder if that shot goes in. Like, it's
interesting because obviously there was a lot that went into it. But you know, I talked to the Storm's GM Talisa Rhea for a new story that's up on ESPN.com right now. And the number one thing she highlighted when I asked about, you know, what went into the evaluation was, we thought we should have gone further in the playoffs.
So I'm like, I honestly hate that answer more than anything, because like, it's so outcome-based, which is fine to be outcome-based, but like the reason that they were in the position and playing the Aces was because of the regular season. You know, like if they get lucky and they upset the Aces and then they go and lose the next round, does that then change the previous history of Noelle Quinn's season? You know, like it doesn't. It's they got lucky in those moments. It's almost like the NCAA tournament coach who like wins an upset game in the NCAA tournament's like, that person like probably shouldn't get more credit or be a hotter coach than the person who like worked hard to get their team to the position to get there. And like they did both or whatever, so that's fine.
Yeah.
But like the outcome-based evaluation of it annoys me as a process. So I do wonder, I'm like, it makes me happy that I was cheering against the Storm in that game, I guess is what I'm saying. That if this is what I wanted for the direction of the franchise, and it felt like both on the court, possibly off the court, kind of overall, the organization just needed a reset. And this season was emblematic of that. And they have the player and they have the picks to be able to do that.
Well, the other part of what I asked Talisa Rhea about was, and related to the fact that she felt the team should have gone further than they did in the playoffs, is, you know, whether this team needs more fundamental change to the roster. And she mentioned how much they believe in this core. Now, obviously, every starter plus Erica Wheeler, unrestricted free agents, you'd have to go out and re-sign those players, most notably Skylar Diggins and Neko Okumike, as free, and Gabby Williams as free agents. But, you know, made it sound very much like they want to sort of continue down this path of, you know, both trying to contend now while developing a next generation of Dominique Malunga, of Jordan Horston, of this LA pick. So if you're thinking like reset on the roster, I don't know that I would expect that.
I think I'm fine with that. I think I'm okay with that, because first off, whoever comes in they're going to be a coach to coach Dom. Like, they are coming in with the knowledge and perspective that like Dominique Malunga is the franchise, right? Like, things changed this last year, and that's who they're going to be hiring for and toward. And Noelle Quinn just wasn't that. And that's part of what my initial upsetness with Noelle Quinn was they didn't have Dom playing enough early.
But I have told you this over and over again.
I know.
The evidence suggests that it is not better to play players right away, that it's better to have them earn minutes.
A couple of games, but this all-time Monday Night Football game, we knew it would be. But you're mad about the Mark Andrews catch. I understand that, have them earn minutes.
It's not
like
the catch. It said he's got a 17.4. When was the last time Mark Andrews scored a 17.4?
They had a breakdown of all of his previous games or his whole season up until now. And then
he had
this
two
game.
Catches for 7 yards. He did have a 2 yard run, though.
are they tush pushy with Mark Andrews?
I don't know.
That route by Amon-Ra was awesome. But I
think that the way that Noelle Quinn handled it in terms of Dominique Blum,
she still wasn't playing.
Was absolutely
enough.
The right
she
way.
Was not playing enough by the end of the season.
I mean, she played a lot in game two. I don't think in game three she was quite as effective as people were hoping that she was going to be coming off of that game two performance against Asia Wilson. I thought she played. I would have gone to her maybe a little earlier in the third quarter for offensive purposes, because, you know, I think that, I mean, Ezzie's the better defender, despite what Dominique Malunga did against Asia Wilson in the stretch of game two. But I do think Dominique Malunga is certainly the more potent offensive player already at this stage of their careers.
I'm fine with the idea of the roster being similar to what it was this year. They have to get younger, at least slightly. But if what you're telling me is, and you kind of hinted at, NECA and Skylar might not be interested in coming back if Noel is gone, and it's just like that.
So last year I wrote about this in the feature that they supported her. They essentially saved her job after, you know, Jewel Lloyd requested for her to be fired. And, you know, there certainly was a question about the performance of the team last year and whether they got far enough. I wouldn't say that's a new question this year. You know, when I spoke to them this year about it, it wasn't quite as strong as they had been on the record last year, I would say. And, you know, one of the things that Talisa Rhea said today was, you know, that she solicited feedback. And I asked if that included players at exit interviews. And she said, yes, you know, it's important to get their feedback. Now, she didn't specifically say anything about Skylar and NECA. I don't think this came as a total shock.
There are three players who matter. She might have asked, and there might even be two players who matter. But like, I'm not saying that she didn't ask everybody, but the amount that you value everybody's perspective is it is NECA and Dom, and then also Skylar, maybe.
Obviously they have the right to change their minds. The other thing I would say about this is I don't think it came as a total shock to them. We spoke to the players on Saturday, the day before this announcement, and Noel Quinn. NECA, you know, talked a lot about the future of the Storm in a way that suggested she was invested in it, perhaps even more so than at exit interviews last year, I would say, when, frankly, Noel Quinn's status was probably unresolved. And Skylar Diggins made it, you know, she apparently had said, one of the questions from Percy Allen of the Seattle Times mentioned that she was on the record as saying she wanted to retire here. I can't remember exactly where that was. I don't remember that now, but she didn't say anything differently that indicated she's not thinking about her future as being in Seattle. So I don't think based on that, you know, making this decision at coach precludes them coming back.
I mean, you would guess that the most likely outcome is they do, right? And then, okay, so it's the offseason now.
Yeah, we can do the whole thing.
Dom is on the roster. Is there anybody else? Tell me you're like, let's do who's in, who's out, who's on the bubble style. Right.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's up to the players ultimately, since they're all unrestricted free agents. We can go through this a little bit.
It's so not exclusively up to the players, but like just your best guess.
But I'm saying even if the Storm wants NECA back, other teams are going to want NECA. That doesn't guarantee she's back. So it's a complex. It's not like are the Seahawks going to cut this player or trade this player situation.
Sure.
So the players who they have under contract is Dom, Lexi Brown, who made a statement on Saturday emphasizing that she is healthy and that she did not think she got the opportunity she deserved from the Storm coaching staff.
Good God.
So,
is there a happy person in the entire roster?
Well, players who play are happy.
Okay.
I mean, I do think like the role of the coach is not to make everybody on the team happy. If everybody on the team is happy, the coach is probably doing a bad job. Or the GM is bringing in the right players who are understanding the rules that they're going to play. And look, some of that is, you know, one of the things I mentioned on Blue Sky in my context for this is when the Storm traded for Lexi Brown, they thought they were going to have Alicia Clark and Katie Lou Samuelson as big parts of the rotation, and having a 5'9" guard alongside them would be acceptable. Instead, a lot of those minutes went to Erica Wheeler and Brittany Sykes, who are 5'7" and 5'9" respectively. And a 5'9" guard was much harder to play defensively. So, you know, there are things like that. The Lee Eriu, like when they traded for Lee Eriu, they didn't know that they were going to draft Dominique Malunga. That was too many centers. There just wasn't room for all of them. So like that would have happened with any coach. And you would have been unhappier if they were playing Lee Eriu more and Dominique Malunga less. So that's an important thing to remember. But anyways, those are the players under contract. Then also from this season's roster, then they'll also get back Jordan Horston and Nika Mule, who missed this year with ACL tears. Horston has been here working out with the team a lot. Then, you know, there's a couple of reserved free agents, but basically McKinsey Holmes and Zaya Cook, basically everyone else is unrestricted, including all the starters. So I would, again, assess in terms of their what they expressed about, you know, the interest in coming back. Skylar at the top of that list. Gabby Williams, I still think, is pretty high. She obviously had a very good relationship with Noel Quinn, but, you know, I think this organization as a whole, she's had a good relationship with, has supported her, you know, through her international play and everything with that. And then she's got the relationship with Dominik Bilunga, who she will also play with this offseason for Fenerbahce, the best basketball club in the world, in the Turkish League and in the Euro League. So that's where Dom's going to play this year, as a level up from where she was playing last year in the Euro Cup. I would put NECA after that again. You know, she spoke about the future, how bright it is, but didn't necessarily commit to anything. Erica Wheeler said the Storm, quote, have dibs on her, but, you know, that she was looking to make more than she.
That's what they should change. I know that this, she's not a restricted free agent. They should change the name of restricted free agent to dibs.
It would be an amazing
first right of dibs.
Ezzie Magbegor, it's going to be interesting because if Dom is back and NECA is back, there's not a starting spot for Ezzie unless you imagine the three of those players playing together, which they did not all season, unless I missed it, until the final two possessions against the Aces were out there for defensive purposes. I did ask Ezzie about that at the exit interviews, and she said she was intrigued by it, like the idea of playing with them. But I don't know if there's necessarily going to be just enough minutes there to justify having all three of those players on the roster. And then Brittany Sykes was interesting. She said 17 games wasn't enough essentially to like feel comfortable in Seattle. So I asked her, like, if 17 games isn't enough, does that mean, you know, you want to come back in free agency? And she was like, oh, that's not what I'm saying.
Then how did Victor Robles do it?
She was, wow. She was like, the Storm are one of the teams I have my eyes on. So that was not a very convincing.
She did not want to be aggregated. WNBA aggregated. Okay. No.
Tiffany Mitchell
WNBA aggregated.
Tiffany Mitchell got aggregated about her unhappiness with her playing time in the playoffs. So that was the aggregation that happened.
My God. Okay.
You bring
I'm not
players.
Even blaming Noel. I'm partially just like, all players who aren't playing are angry. All players who aren't playing are fine.
Mackenzie Holmes was excited about her opportunity.
Maybe this is like, I don't know. At the very least, there might have needed to be some communication at some part. I'm not necessarily saying this was Noel's job, maybe this front office or whatever. A lot of people didn't seem to have a good understanding of what their roles would be.
Yes, I think that's fair. So I would say I also, like, frankly, the Brittany Sykes trade didn't work. She was not good in the playoffs.
That's not a hot take. If you were to retrade grade that one, it's an F now.
And I gave it a solid B+. I disrespected the sanctity of the B+ with that trade grade.
Should be like Pitchfork and retrade grade.
I mean, we've done it before. We'll do
Have
it
you?
Again. None of the W's.
I'll do it again too. Try and stop me.
So I think Sykes and Malunga, and Sykes and Ezzie are pretty big question marks among the starting lineup. I do think if I had to bet on it, I think it is better than 50-50 that all three of Skylar, Neck, and Gabby will be back. But I don't think it's anywhere close to like 70% that they'll all be back.
What are the teams in, let's talk NECA specifically, because she's the one who has the most demand right now, the most leverage.
Golden State's a really appealing option for her.
Okay, so is it Golden State? But none of the like really, really big teams.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know that Jonquel Jones is going to be back in New York after the way their season ended. That was the other team she considered before signing with the Storm.
Are there free agents?
I would say that's a distinct possibility.
That you would be interested. Let's give a hypothetical that it is Skylar, Dom, NECA are back. Are there any free agents that you would say the Storm should be targeting or likely will be targeting?
They need more shooting.
I'm aware.
Carly Samuelson is someone I traded for in the mock off season with the Storm. They ended up signing her sister, Katie Lou Samuelson, who became a free agent and unfortunately just wasn't able to play this season because she suffered an ACL tear during training camp. She also played for the Storm back in 2021. Carly Samuelson didn't really play. She was on the bench. I wouldn't be shocked if she was someone that they would look at again. The other thing is you got to sort of figure out where this draft pick is.
Have to make this decision also? Like, when does free agency happen vis-a-vis
the draft?
Yeah.
Free agency, you know, in a traditional schedule, everything's subject to when the CBA gets finished this year. Traditionally, it happens in February and the draft is in April.
Okay. So we're about to head into a long WNBA break.
Yeah. So Flauje Johnson from LSU would be the player I think is the best fit probably with the Storm core.
When is the lottery?
Presumably late November, but Talisa said that they had not set heard a date as yet, because that was one of the questions I asked, is if they wanted a coach in place by then. And she said, probably, but we don't, it, if you don't know the date, you can't really tie to it.
They're going to have a coach by then. Okay, so tell us about some of...
One of the things you could do is wait until after the lottery, and if you, you know, end up one or two, it's a more attractive coaching job, perhaps, to some degree.
Is there that big of a difference?
It's not one of those years where there's like an obvious number one pick.
I don't really buy that. The rules change. It's still a head coaching job, like.
Yeah, and it's a
you're
team
not trying
that
to
has good facilities.
Pete Carroll out of its retirement. Like, I don't.
It's a team that has good facilities. It's a team that has, you're going to come in and be able to
compete.
They're
up there with signature WNBA franchises.
Without question. Tied for
it's
the
like,
most championships.
Like the Aces, the Sparks, the Liberty, and the Storm are kind of like
the Lynx.
Are the Lynx like a long term, like signature franchise?
The team that has won four championships?
Okay. All right. The Lynx, too. For sure.
Yeah. And might add a fifth this year. I mean, is the heavy favorite to add a fifth, I should say. So.
Okay. All then right. On the two different questions for you, because we're doing Storm wrapping up the offseason. Number one is, assuming the pick is, let's say it's three, right? That's the most likely outcome.
Yes.
Who are the players we should be watching as we head toward the women's basketball, college basketball season?
I mean, obviously, we'll have more time to do that and circle in on it. But
no, we have
Miles,
to do it right now.
Olivia Miles is back in the mix after the Storm could have potentially taken her last year, and she opted not to go into the draft. And I think it's become very clear that Dominique Malunga was a better prospect than Olivia Miles. Not that there should have been much question about that then. Izzy Fudd from UConn, his huge prospect going into UConn, has dealt with a variety of injuries, got healthy last year, dominant performance in the national championship game. You're still a little bit on potential there. She hasn't put it together for a full season, but hopefully she will stay healthy and do that in her final year. I mentioned Flaje Johnson from LSU, the best athlete, you know, a lot of similarities in many ways to Jewel Lloyd. They're not identical players, but you know, that kind of player type. And the Storm has a very clear need for a shooting guard with size, you know, if they bring back this core. There's a Spanish center named Awa Pham, who is considered perhaps the best prospect in this draft.
Interesting.
Probably not a great fit for a team that has Dominique Malunga, but certainly, and not someone you're going to be watching necessarily on a regular basis, but
is that, wait, can you
knowing.
Spell her name?
Awafam. Awa Pham.
Awa Pham, okay. Is that maybe even like her rise, is that good for the Storm if they're basically like, we're set big with Dom, but it might push one of the guards down?
Yes. And then the last player I think who's in the mix for the top five going into the season is Lauren Betts from UCLA, another, you know, 6'7", 6'8" post player. So.
Okay. On the flip side, then maybe a little bit sooner, who are some of the best candidates for head coach job?
All right. So, all right. One of the things I thought was interesting from my conversation with Talisa Rhea today was I asked her about the timing, and you know, she said they want to move quickly. So there, no other teams have fired their coaches after the season. There are those, the two openings for Portland and Toronto. It'll be interesting to see if Noel Quinn could be in the mix for one of those jobs. Cause you know, Talisa mentioned like wanting to move quickly, both for their sake, but also for Noel Quinn's sake, so that she could, you know, look at other opportunities being, you know, in the last year of her contract. So, but she mentioned wanting to give themselves the opportunity to talk to people who, let me find the exact quote here because I don't want to misquote this. We aren't doing ourselves a disservice by not having the opportunity to talk to certain people. So I guess that could be a reference to assistant coaches who are still in the playoffs, but it made me wonder about Sandy Brondello. There's been some questions about her job security with the New York Liberty after they had kind of a disappointing regular season, lost in the first round to the Phoenix Mercury, despite a pretty heroic effort from Breanna Stewart in game three, playing through an MCL sprain. And this is also interesting because the name that I have circled for a long time for the Storm that I mentioned on Blue Sky yesterday is Sonia Roman, who is an assistant to Brondello for the New York Liberty. Previously was an assistant coach for 3 years with the Memphis Grizzlies, kind of making an unexpected leap. Before that, she had been the head coach at of the MIT women. So a pretty massive, but like Natalie Nicasse, her success with the Golden State Valkyries, I think, and Nate Tibbett's success with the Phoenix Mercury too, I think is going to make NBA experience really attractive to coaches this cycle. And that points to Sonia Roman, who happens to have some local ties. Her wife, Melina Flores, who played at Stanford and very briefly in the WNBA, is from Snohomish, lives in Seattle now. So I don't know if Sonia Roman actually makes her offseason home in Seattle or did during the NBA season, but she was in Seattle a lot during training camp 2024 after she had been let go by the Memphis Grizzlies before she signed on with the Liberty for this season. So that's an interesting name to me. And one of the possibilities is Sandy Brondello and Sonia Roman, one of them will coach the Liberty and one of them will coach the Storm next season, and who it is up to the Liberty. Hey, this is Kevin. Between when we recorded this segment on Monday night and when we're releasing it on Tuesday morning, the New York Liberty have announced that they are not renewing Sandy Brondello's contract as head coach, same as the Storm did with Noel Quinn. And Brondello immediately shoots to the top of the wish list for Storm head coach. She actually does have some ties here. She finished her career as a player in 2003 with a year with the Storm. That was my first year covering the team for the organization. But more importantly, it's the championship pedigree of having coached the Phoenix Mercury to a title in 2014, one of the great seasons in WNBA history, the New York Liberty in 2024 to a championship. You want to talk about going deeper in the playoffs, turning the corner as Talisa Rhea did. Sandy Brondello is the candidate who can potentially do that for you. So if she is interested, I think she is now the heavy favorite to be the Storm's next head coach. So,
okay, fair enough.
Some other candidates we should go through. I think some former head coaches are candidates. You've got Eric Thibault, who's on Cheryl Reeve's staff right now in Minnesota after coaching in Washington. I think doing a pretty good job there, but was let go as a organizational shakeup that included his dad, Mike Thibault, who was running the team as GM. Latricia Chammell was with the Dallas Wings the last couple of years, got them to the playoffs, which is a minor miracle. This season, I think, has not gone the way that they were expecting. Replacing her, it's you know, reflected well in her. She spent this year, joined the Sparks midseason as kind of their defensive coordinator, helped oversee their defensive turnaround. And notably, she was on the LA Sparks staff when Neka Gumake was there. So that could be an interesting choice from that standpoint. And then Tanisha Wright, longtime Storm guard, one of the all-time leaders in games played in franchise history, was with the Atlanta Dream the last few years. You know, never really got an opportunity to coach an Atlanta team that was as healthy or as loaded as the team that got the number three seed this year. But, you know, I think merits another opportunity. As far as first timers, besides Roman, Breon January, another former Storm guard, is from Spokane, so has some local ties. She's with the Indiana Fever right now, has been an assistant to Stephanie White since she retired from the Storm in 2022. And, you know, the Fever's playoff run is earning a lot of credit right now. Christy Tolliver, someone else who's an assistant on a team that somewhat unexpectedly made the semifinals in the Mercury, a very respected longtime WNBA guard, certainly a future head coach. And then Rebecca Brunson is another assistant to Cheryl Reeve in Minnesota, who's been there the longest of all their current assistants, another longtime WNBA player who would be a first-time candidate. And the other thing I would say, so we saw two college coaches last year. My first call, if I were the Storm, would be to Lindsay Gottlieb at USC. I think she's an outstanding coach. Hasn't broken through and made the Final Four yet at USC, but only a matter of time, I think, with the talent that they've been attracting there. And, you know, her chops as a coach, another person who has NBA experience from her time as assistant with the Cleveland Cavaliers. I don't think she would make that leap. The college coaches who did it last year were, you know, from FGCU in Carl Smesko's case and Utah in Lynn Roberts' case, not one of the biggest and highest paying colleges in the universe in the country. So I don't think she would take it. Maybe they consider some other college coaches. I had someone throw out Kelly Graves is a possibility. Certainly a respected offensive mind who hasn't had the same level of success there since Sabrina Ionescu left and Satu Sabali. But, you know, that's in, you know, it could be someone completely out of left field, but those are the names I'm looking at.
Okay.
So there we go.
I think we don't need to recap the Apple Cup necessarily anymore. We talked about DeMond, and I just want to get into Ohio State. Like I said,
One other thing we should say. Well, I mean, we should talk about a couple of big things. Sure, things. They haven't had a non-kneel drive that did not end in points. Christian Cable pointed this out on that, like, since the second quarter against Colorado State. They've gone five halves without punting. Like, that's pretty impressive. 12 consecutive touchdown drives.
I'm aware of this information. It was very embarrassing when they had to kick a field goal. But also banged it through. That was one of the plays where I was like,
during this game.
That kind of gave me a little bit of like, okay. But obviously everything, even since the move to the Big Ten, you know, like this game has been there were two of them. There was hosting Michigan last year. Obviously, win for UW, avenging the national championship until Michael Penix was able to do it the year after that. And then this one is the biggest one, right? The biggest team you can play in the Big Ten there is right now, the number one team in the country. The Huskies, thinking about this, that stat that they showed about playing the number one team in the country, which was they haven't beaten the number one team in the country since 1961, which is why I'm very confident they will this weekend. And they haven't even played the number one team in the country since 2007. So this is not an opportunity. It's going to come up more often.
Was this at Husky Stadium?
I think. Oh, is that at Oregon Husky Stadium?
Oregon was number one last year.
Oh, okay. So that's at Husky Stadium.
Literally, DeMond Williams Jr. has started against the number one team in the country. Yes,
all right, fair enough. Yeah, Husky old Stadium. Hat for him. Okay, fine. So for at Husky Stadium.
Six starts will be against the number one team in the country. Pretty wild. Yeah, I looked this up a while ago. Before the last non-Pete Carroll, also the Michigan when they played them, fun fact, was the number one team
fair
in
enough,
the country.
Yes. Yeah.
Before at Husky Stadium, the last non-Pete Carroll team was Ohio State in 1969.
So not something that happens often, obviously.
No.
And I think
it's gonna happen a lot more often now, but no.
The thing that is interesting to me about it as we dive into this game is obviously it's like from our end, it's DeMond Williams, right? And the two things that are going to be paid attention to is basically DeMond has done this shit this year against bad teams. He does have experience doing it against very good defenses. I would probably venture to guess that despite the throttling that they took at the hands of Ohio State last year, Oregon's defense was probably a better defense than Ohio State's defense is now.
I mean, Oregon's defense from a year ago is the best of these three, but I'll double check on that.
Defensively last year? I don't know.
Wasn't Penn State better on defense last year than offense?
Than Oregon? I think that was pretty freaking good defense. But
Oregon was 21st on defense.
Really?
You're aware that Oregon is a very offensive-minded team. Sometimes stereotypes are true. Penn State was number 7 in FBI efficiency last year.
Exactly the same as Ohio State is this year right now.
Yes.
So DeMond has played a defense that is this good. And I think the thing that I look at is just looking at FBI efficiencies, which is college football FBI. I think Ohio State might be number 2. Yes. Number 2 overall.
No.
That takes in.
Oh, I'm looking at last year. Yeah.
That factors in a little bit of like the Ohio State-ness of it all, right? That is preseason polls and things like that. Strictly speaking of how they have played this year, if you were to say the 23rd best team in the country is hosting the 8th best team in the country, and again, this is removing the Ohio State-ness surrounding it, I don't think you would go into that game and say the hosting team has no chance of winning this game.
Is someone saying the Huskies have no chance of winning this game?
That person's name is Katie, but
well, this is not my emotional ballot.
To me, that would be the type of game that I would look at, especially it's so fascinating to see. Ohio State doesn't have weaknesses, obviously, but like seeing the strength on strength, weakness on weakness across the board. But also when you're factoring in, it is the first ever road start for that quarterback, the quarterback of the visiting team. I am shocked that the spread is where it is right now. I get that they're Ohio State. But
I'm not shocked. The Huskies aren't even receiving votes.
It is. I'm shocked that the Huskies aren't receiving votes either. These motherfuckers don't have computers who are voting or whatever. But like, this is a moment when we can see. This isn't just a gut feeling right now. This isn't just like, I think that they can do it. This is, even statistically speaking, this game is probably closer than wherever the spread is. The spread's obviously getting closer than where it started at. And moving by 3 to 4 points in various different places, people are starting to recognize that this is an offense. And granted, the quality of opponent isn't great, but like UC Davis isn't a bad FBS team that they played. And just objectively speaking about it, this game should be in the like 4-point range.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but I do agree. I mean, the reason you do the FBI involving preseason is because that's more predictive. Because the other piece of this with the efficiency is they've played 3 games apiece. Ohio State one of, you know, only one of those games has been a meaningful game where they have actually like had to play their hardest to win. And they did great in that game. You know, they did good in the game. So I do think the Huskies are underrated. I do not think that Ohio State is overrated as the number one team in the country.
I'm not necessarily saying like they're overrated. It's kind of.
But to your point about the difference between them, FPI has it as a 9-point difference, basically. And okay, I don't know exactly what they'd factor in home field.
Nine points is.
It'd probably be about 6 when you factored in home field. And when you factored in the first road start, yeah, I can see maybe getting it into the 5 range.
I guess the part that's scary is they were thought to Cario Davis against Wazoo. Zebiak House looked really good.
They got torched for 2.5 solid quarters, maybe 3 quarters. And they also lost one of their key defensive starters in Buda Ogda, who will be out for this game and is out for several weeks, according to
Jed Fish. He's out. Oh, my God.
So hopefully Cario Davis is back. Jed Fish did say if he can't play, it's going to be a cornerback competition. Last week, Leroy Bryant started, was benched in favor of freshman Dylan Robinson, who came in and had the highest PFF rating, I think, on the team defensively.
I mean, Leroy Bryant did not look good. Saw a lot of him not making plays in that game. He was behind receivers catching the ball.
It was a tough start for him. But Robinson forced the Eckhouse fumble with that very impressive peanut punch. And then Russia and Clark, who has also been playing nickel, would be in the mix for that spot too.
I mean, it's going to be hugely important to hopefully have Takario back. The boot injury is pretty brutal right now, just to have that the week before. And that was kind of the only thing where it's like, we wanted to see the Huskies offense look amazing against Wazoo, but try to get out of there scot-free. And it's like more or less one of their most important defenders. I thought Zeviak House played a good game for what it's worth, because there was pressure. And he made good plays. And I actually, what's dude's name? Jimmy Rogers. I thought he schemed up a pretty good game as well. Like, I was kind of like,
I think
they've got
coach.
Receivers
I think they're
open.
Gonna be, especially offensively, I think they're going to be good next year. Maybe even the rest of this year. After whatever happened at quarterback during fall camp.
It is funny, Old Dominion's number 17 in FBI efficiencies.
But those are the undisputed source. That's why if the Huskies were to play at Old Dominion, they would be huge underdogs.
I probably would be, based on how people respect the Husky team. But at the same time,
Old Dominion is 2-1. I don't think they're receiving votes.
This offense is relentless. And that was what I was telling Katie during the game.
Oh, you know why they're rating so good?
Why?
They only lost by 13 at Indiana. Legitimately
really?
Impressive.
Wow.
Unironically impressive.
What I was telling Katie during this game, as she was shitting her pants the entire time, was this offense is relentless. And when you need to score basically on every single drive against them as the defense, if you're Wazoo or UC Davis or maybe Ohio State, it is a very difficult standard to uphold. Right now,
Ohio State is going to need to score every drive.
I don't think so either. But the Huskies might be the team that needs to score every drive, if we're being honest with ourselves. But right now, ranked 5th in the country in offense, up there with Oregon, Florida State, USC, teams like that. And Florida State, we saw what they did. They're number 1 in FBI efficiency on offense. And they clobbered Alabama in that game, right? They beat them pretty comfortably. The rest of those teams are all undefeated and have all looked very good. There's a huge Vanderbilt victory against South Carolina. USC looked awesome on Saturday night. And it's kind of like when you have an offense that is one of the top 5 in the country, and there are a lot of teams in the country, it is basically offensively this Husky team has looked exactly like what we thought it would look like between the combination of Denzel, Jonah, and DeMond, and everybody's kind of playing their part right now. So it is a very high standard to have defensively if you're Ohio State, and then also offensively coming back, because the Huskies are going to score in this game.
I don't know if this Ohio State team is as good as the Michigan team that the Huskies played in the CFP championship. I would say that's probably the comparison if you're talking about this quality of offense, like giving you a chance. Like it did, but also, you know, the Huskies just couldn't get the stops that they needed. And then
when you look at that Michigan team, like first off, the way that Ryan Day is not Jim Harbaugh. Like the way that Jim Harbaugh is able to game plan that shit and just make it happen. But that defense was phenomenal. And you look at the amount of NFL talent that they had on the team. Ohio State's going to have a lot of very impressive players also, but like top to bottom, the amount of players that are playing in the NFL from that Michigan team at a high level is massive. It was a phenomenal Michigan team. Where were they ranked defensively in the country?
Number one.
Number, yeah. I mean, they were like, they were, and they were
number four
team.
In offense. Like, they were, that was an awesome.
That team, that's not comparable to the,
but
this
it might
Ohio
be.
State.
I don't see how you can rule that out.
They might win by as many points, but that Michigan team is better than this Ohio State team right now.
I just don't think you can say that at this
point. By the end of this, they won the fucking national championship. Yes, I can.
No, you can say that they're that good, but you just don't know how good this Ohio State team is going to be.
Okay. If I would be very surprised if this Ohio State team was undefeated and won the national championship comfortably. How about that?
I don't know that anyone's ever going to go. I mean, I don't know that
they did not that long ago. Like,
they didn't have to play three playoff games. It's a different world already. I guess
they beat Ohio State in, like, I think they went into Ohio State, and maybe that was at home. Maybe they won that game at home. But like, they played Ohio State at the very end of the season. Then they dominated the Big Ten championship game. Then they beat Alabama. Then they beat us. I'm sorry, but
they're a really good team. I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying this could be a really amazing Ohio State team.
Sure.
We just don't know yet because it's too early in the season.
I think it is very unlikely that they are as good as that team. But it doesn't matter. We're not that team. They're not that team. It doesn't matter. But it is a different brand of number one team in the country, I guess is kind of what you're saying.
So let's talk about how Ohio State got here. They did it by beating, you become the number one by beating the number one Texas 14-7 in the season opener. They were outgained 336 to 203 in that game, intriguingly. They then beat Grambling State 70-0, Ohio 37-9 before taking a bye last week. The two big changes, obviously a lot of changes, many, many new players, but the two biggest changes. So Chip Kelly goes to the NFL with the Raiders. Brian Hartline is back as the sole offensive coordinator. He was technically co-offensive coordinator last season, but Chip Kelly was calling plays. It was pretty clearly his offense. And then, as you mentioned, quarterback, where third-year sophomore Julian Sayin has taken over as the starter. He's number eight so far in QBR in the Big Ten. He's completing 79% of his passes for nearly 11 yards per attempt, but has thrown three picks. And most of that production was against Grambling and Ohio. He went 18 of 9 without a single pass hitting the ground against Grambling, which is remarkable. Against Texas, he was 13 of 20 for 126 yards and basically avoided mistakes in that game. And as you mentioned, first career road start, not a rushing threat, which I think is probably a good news for the Husky defense.
They gained 203 yards in that game against Texas. If we're being like, if we are leaving that game, Texas FPI efficiency wise ranks number 21, the 68th best offense in the country.
Again,
and that offense,
not enough of a sample to say how good these teams are yet.
Okay. Texas's offense has not played that well. And in that game, they still gained 336 yards on the road. This was in a game that they gained 336 yards on the road at the number one team. Or not, they weren't number one at the time, at the number three team at the time. People left that game being like, Arch Manning is bad.
I think that also may be a reaction to the expectations for Arch Manning.
I mean, he was 17 of 30 for a touchdown and a pick. They still just gained a chunk of yards. Like,
so Ohio State
they outplayed Ohio State in the game.
I'm not quite ready to go there.
They gained 136 more yards.
How many more plays did they run?
Touchdown.
Like, what was the yards per play in that game? They don't make it
Ohio
easy
State
on the
averaged 2.3 yards per carry.
I agree that Ohio State was not very impressive offensively in that game.
I mean, Ohio State had more time of possession. I don't know how many plays they ran, but I think...
So here's one of the things that's happened since this game that's going to be very interesting to watch. They had two running backs who split carries against Texas. West Virginia transfer C.J. Donaldson has gotten the most carries, followed by sophomore James Peoples. The two of them combined have not averaged as many yards per carry this season, in part because he didn't play against Texas. As true freshman Lamar Jackson... Who, you know, it would be too confusing if he went by Lamar Jackson because there's a pretty famous football player by that name. So instead he goes by his nickname. Do you know what his nickname is?
Bo?
Bo Jackson.
Incredible.
Nine carries for 108 yards against Grambling. Nine carries for 109 yards against Ohio. Obviously not a strong set of competition, but I am scared of Bo Jackson.
We should be scared of Bo Jackson. Bo, especially without Budalakta
running. The other thing we should be scared of is Jeremiah Smith, who was held in check against Texas, six catches for 43 yards, then had 272 yards and three touchdowns the last 2 weeks. The thing I think if you're taking hope for the Huskies is that the receiving depth isn't there right yet. They've got Jeremiah Smith. They've got Carnell Tate, who's the only other receiver with more than five catches or 70 yards. So if you do have Dakario Davis and Ephesians Prysock healthy and can lock down the two of those guys, maybe there's a chance. That's what you're hoping for.
I mean, yeah, just wait till Jeremiah Smith seed cornerback competition between Leroy Bryant, Rayshon Clark, and Drew Freeman, Dalen Robinson.
If it is those guys, I have concerns.
What is his name? Dalen Robinson?
Dylan.
Dylan Robinson. Yeah, just wait till Jeremiah Smith gets a load of that. The secondary was bad against Wazoo.
Yeah.
That's my review. I mean, Takario's a huge part of it. I didn't see
Jeremiah Smith out there.
I actually think like that's going to matter. The running is what is going. It's going to be a fucking Big Ten game, right? It's their first Big Ten game since they played last year, and that was the difference when playing against Big Ten teams was they could just line up and run the ball all over you. And the size on the lines, like the Ohio State line, makes me nervous that they're not going to come into this game expecting Julian Sain to lead the team, right? Like, they're not wanting this to be a Jeremiah Smith game. They're wanting to say, we are going to physically impose ourselves on this Husky front seven. And without Buddha, they might be able to do it. So you're in, like, are we able to, like, penalties, holds, the huge thumbs up, plays that lose yardage, things like that, getting them off schedule and forcing Julian Sain to have to do something in this game. That's especially if Takario's there.
You wanted to look like last year's Michigan game.
I don't think they come out and be and scoring early. You know, like if UW gets the ball first and comes down and scores a touchdown, keeping pressure on them.
Yeah,
and
not
I think,
a game to defer, in my opinion.
Oh, I think you should always defer still. Because if you're going back and forth and then get the ball first in the second half, I don't know. I'm deferring. But if they win the toss and it's 2U, then you've got to come down and score. It has to be relentless, is what I'm saying. The offense has to be relentless in this game. They're 107th in FBI efficiency on defense. This Husky defense is not going to stop Ohio State. They have to score more points.
Yeah. The Ohio State defense has allowed 118.3 passing yards per game, 52% completions. Not a ton of turnovers. They've only forced 5 so far, or sacks. They've got 7 of those in 3 games and have been a tiny bit more vulnerable on the ground. So maybe it's more of a Jonah Coleman game than a DeMond Williams Jr. game from that standpoint. Texas ran for 166 yards on 37 attempts in that game. Junior Arvell Reese, really the breakout player for this Ohio State defense so far. He's got a team-high 22 tackles and has recorded a pair of sacks as an off-ball linebacker. So.
And have they faced a rushing quarterback? Like, Julian Sain's not a rushing quarterback, like you mentioned. I mean, I guess I just don't know enough about...
Arch is a rushing quarterback.
I
don't know if he's
that
as good as DeMond Williams, but...
You don't know if he's... I know if he's as good as DeMond Williams. You don't be the greatest quarterback of all time and have somebody be better than you. I mean, like, DeMond's going to be better than 10 for 38. There's just no chance that he's not.
Okay.
In this game. And I don't think that they've faced a quarterback like that. And to have, like, Arch just can't do the things that DeMond can do. Right?
He was considered the consensus number one pick coming into the year.
Are you joking with me? You actually think there's a chance that Arch Manning is as good as DeMond Williams?
Have a little fucking humility coming into this game, for God's sake. It's the number one team in the country. They could beat us by 70 points.
No, they couldn't.
I mean, I don't think they're going to score that many points, but
it's not going to be an Oregon performance.
Have a little humility here.
None. My humility is
this
about
is
the
all
defense.
Setting up for me to clip this next week.
Fine, clip it. You're going to dunk on me for having confidence in this Husky offense? Absolutely not. DeMond Williams hasn't done. He went on the road at Penn State and at Oregon. This shit means nothing to DeMond Williams.
Okay, cool. Did the Huskies win those games? Remind me.
He played really good in both of them. And the other thing from the
did
Wazoo
the
game,
Huskies win those games? Remind me.
What offensive line was DeMond? Has Julian Sain played on the road yet? Has Julian Sain done anything like that?
I think that's a nice edge for the Huskies.
I'm 13 of 20. He just,
but it's possible that Julian Sain does not need to throw a pass in this game for them to win. Like, that's on the table.
I agree
that
that is on the table.
Consider that possibility.
That's what I'm saying is that that is the thing that makes me the most nervous, is that Ohio State is able to come out, and that is going to be the game plan. We know it. We saw it last year, right? We've seen it with a lot of these, like, real Big Ten teams and coming here, and the Husky front seven is just not up to speed in that aspect. But I will say, Wazoo can't run the fucking ball, of course, but Wazoo didn't run the ball against UW.
Great. They didn't. They didn't have to.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I'm excited to see it. Should we do percentage chances of victory?
35%.
50-50.
50-50. Huh. Okay. All right. All right. Well, let's talk about the Seahawks.
Oh, yeah. You should be way more enthusiastic about the number one team by DVOA. Your Seattle Seahawks.
No, I mean,
it has been a while.
I'm not unenthusiastic about talking about the Seahawks. I'm unenthusiastic about your optimism about Ohio State.
How could you be unenthusiastic about optimism?
Because it leads, hope is a dangerous thing.
I will tell you, me and Katie balance each other out. We are the yin and the yang of this game.
So you're saying that when I'm there, I tilt it too much in the negative spectrum? Oops, all Katie's?
Oops, yeah, no, you definitely do. I'm being there. It's like a different experience. The fear that you feel, like right now, I can feel one thing, but being in that stadium, the amount, like when the Huskies give up a touchdown, like they'll probably give up a touchdown right away.
Talked about all the Niners fans there a couple weeks ago. I can't imagine Ohio State fans are going to travel pretty strong for a game in Seattle in September.
It is going to be a lot of Ohio State fans. We didn't talk about that either. I mean, we dealt with it with Michigan. Like, it just really depends on how the game goes.
Yeah, it does. We deal with it every year.
I will say
Oregon.
It is different at Husky Stadium than it is at Lumen Field.
Yes, I agree with that. The visiting fan bases in college football, with the notable exception of Oregon fans, tend to actually be quite friendly, partially because of the fact that the teams that travel the best are the teams that are the best, and therefore they're not like, oh, this hated rivalry against UW. They're like, oh, hey, this will be a fun new opponent for us to stomp.
Yeah. I think that's fair. Maybe it's just like the Husky Stadium welcomes that atmosphere, and maybe it's just like the Lumen Field atmosphere is like a little bit more violent, which it is.
I mean, yes, the atmosphere at Lumen Field is just different for a lot of reasons than the atmosphere at Husky Stadium. But I don't anticipate there's going to be like any trouble with Ohio State fans.
No, absolutely not. Anyway, why are we talking about that? Let's talk about the number one team by DVOA, the Seattle Seahawks. Get the game on Sunday against the Saints. It was a mild atmosphere, is what I will say. Like, heading into the game, people were sitting, people were calm. I would say they're confident, maybe.
Wow. See, I was feeling pretty nervous is kickoff approach. Now, when JSN was questionable with the illness, that was like peak, uh-oh, this is a trap game. The Seahawks always lose these kinds of games at home's moment. The fact that JSN suited up relieved that a little bit. But what relieved it a lot was watching the game.
It was when the game started. It's funny because I did that. I actually had to remind myself, because it's almost hard to like get up for like games like this, even in the NFL, right? Like a game against the Saints where it's like, I just can't get that like too excited, because best case scenario is what happened and you crush the team. Worst case scenario, it's an embarrassing loss. Other worst case scenario is you play a little bit too close with the Saints.
Right.
And that is exactly what we didn't want to have happen. And I was kind of like, it's almost like a no-win game, except when you beat the crap out of the Saints like the Seahawks did. They found a way to go and win this game overall, and DVOA recognized that. Now, the thing that I had to do was I was looking at like the Panthers-Falcons score and the Browns are just beating the Packers. And I'm like, this is the NFL. Any team can beat any team. There are no games that the outcome is decided before you go in, because the Panthers didn't just beat the Falcons. They beat them 30-0. And so that's what gave me a healthy bit of nervousness. But I think there's definitely, I mean, I'm the Packers, I'm sure, feel this way as well. But like, even after the first drive, when the Saints go for it on that fourth down and the Seahawks stop it, I'm kind of like, we're winning this game. Like, they came out with a couple of good plays and it was a little bit of like, oh, they might have a little something here. After that happened, it was just so fast that they scored after that. And I was like, it's over. Honestly, after the first touchdown, I felt it. And it felt like, to me, a game that was never going to be close at that point. I didn't think they were going to pour it on quite the way that they did, and how it just kept coming and coming and coming the way that
you did expect them to return a punt for a touchdown and block a punt that led immediately to a touchdown. You didn't expect that.
Here's what I will say that what the Seahawks did to the Saints in this game, and it is a soccer term. I think the Seahawks outclassed the Saints in this game.
I agree.
It wasn't like there were things that didn't go right for the Seahawks overall, especially by the end. Some of the penalties stacked up. The run game is still bad. Like that to me, I left this being like, we can be happy about so many things as it pertains to the Seahawks. And it is funny that the one thing that we brought in Clint Kubiak to do, I think, as far as I understand, which was revamp the run game, still is bad.
Oh, but they committed to that run game. I mean, it's easy to commit to the run game when you're up.
There was a person in the stands, like two people over, and they're like, yeah, you have to establish the run. And I'm like, I just want to sit you all down. They worked on establishing the run throughout the game, but all credit to John Schneider right now, because they went out there with a roster that didn't have Nicky Manwari, that didn't have Julian Love, that didn't have Devin Witherspoon. And even talent wise in that secondary, I get it was the Saints, but like, this is with a Torrey Horton making a big play in this one. Like, this was a little bit of found talent that they had to go out there and absolutely dominate the Saints.
I like that you just had a credit to John Schneider take, and you didn't mention Sam Darnold.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Darion Kendrick, like, right? Like, players like that. Darion Kendrick, Josh Jobe, Sam Darnold is like, he still is like one of the highest. I think he's the highest paid player on the team.
I'm sure he is, but he's relative to quarterbacks and it's relative to Geno Smith. And
no, we could talk about Sam Darnold in a second, but I thought in general to deal with those injuries and just have it not be a factor at all.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like the other element of winning this game so easily, the starters on defense played probably a little longer than I would have preferred, but to be able to get as many guys out as early as you did with a game coming on Thursday night, especially in contrast to Arizona, who played a hard-fought game with San Francisco to the very end, literally the final buzzer, a very powerful contrast in the Seahawks' favor here.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see as far as health goes. I thought Reek Woolen played a game. I mean, I'm curious what the broadcast said, where maybe there was one penalty, but beyond that, he just didn't come up that much. And to me, that's a good thing. Jobe had the penalties. I still thought played quite a good game overall.
I'm not too pressed about the penalties. I mean, they're a concern, but I'm not, you know.
What was the, you said you've seen the PFF grades or most of the PFF grades. For the defense, what was the kind of general consensus?
It was good.
But who in particular?
I would need to go back in the archives, but I feel like Darion Kendrick probably rated pretty well.
I mean, Darion Kendrick had a great game, had the pick. Ty Okada, like, that was one week one, took a lot of heat. He was coming in kind of blind, obviously. And again, Ty Okada's name not being brought up that much, which is nice.
But Ty Okada was playing a different role in this one, where Ty Okada was actually playing safety as opposed to playing nickel, as he had been in place of Nick Emanwari. So I think that may be a, you know, more comfortable situation for him and put him in a better situation to succeed. And you don't need him in that nickel spot because that's where Darion Kendrick is.
Yeah.
And
they haven't figured out.
Is the backup to Devin Witherspoon.
That's why they traded up to draft Darion Kendrick.
Let's see here. The Bob Condotta posted, yeah, Darion Kendrick was number one in terms of defensive grade.
Darion Kendrick.
It's the Darion Kendrick era. Mike Morris was number two in his limited snap count. Ty Okada number three. So yeah, some unlikely.
I mean,
stars
that's incredible.
Out there on defense.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what you want to see right now, and that's what also goes to show there's talent and the scheme is good, and they were playing against Spencer Rattler.
Well, they will not be playing against Spencer Rattler this week.
Wait, hold on. I have more thoughts on the Saints game.
Okay,
we're just moving on from that. I mean, the other pieces of it was. Right, Spencer Rattler hadn't played that bad in the first two games of the season.
No.
Now, again, I'm giving it to John Mateer. Spencer Rattler is bad, and he was bad in college. Spencer Rattler has not been good at any point. So he was going to be bad no matter what. But the fact that it was these players who are doing it and that Mike McDonald, who was doing it scheming-wise, and to be without those players, that was very impressive. The way that they beat them, we talk about this all the time, when you want to be one of the really good teams, You don't just beat the Saints, which we have spent, I would say, not a decade, not quite that long. We've spent like 7 to 8 years now of just kind of almost beating the really bad teams. Right? Like, that has been a thing. The Seahawks have not crushed these teams since peak Legion of Boom era.
Almost beating means losing. And they've done some of that. Plenty of that. But I think you mean like, barely beating.
Barely beating. I think barely and almost are synonyms, but okay.
Not in this context. Almost means not quite.
Okay, fine. Okay, they were barely beating these teams.
I don't think they're... I don't know that they're synonyms in any context, but they are definitely not in this context. All right, well, let's move on.
I will say I hate semantics more than anything on the face of the earth now, thanks to you. I loathe semantics. But the... And words don't matter. But... but to dominate these games in the way that the Seahawks did in this one, and even the way that they dominated Pittsburgh last week, not score-wise as much, but statistically, is like, that is how you become number one in DVOA. And that is how you become number one in the NFC West in point differential. I want to say run differential because it's a baseball podcast, in point differential. But like, that is who this Seahawks team can be. All of a sudden, I think we have to be looking at it and saying, through 3 weeks, the Seahawks team can be a Super Bowl contender, which I would go back to all the people this offseason, because that's the other point for this game. I was talking to Chris, who wasn't at week one, and I would say he was half paying attention to the Steelers game last week. And he was kind of like complaining about Sam Darnold to me a little bit. And I was
Chris
like,
paying attention to instead of the Seahawks Steelers game.
Chris has a very active drinking life on Saturday nights.
Okay.
Is what I will say. He's it was not an the early person game, who's waking up and at 10 a.m. looking for unadulterated red zone. Maybe in the same way that we are this weekend, like the coming weekend, I'm like, Luca, here's our plan. I'm like, we are going to wake up. We're getting McDonald's breakfast. We have no other things to do. I'm like, 10 a.m. is going to be red zone until red zone is off the air. So that got a pretty big Sunday ahead of us. Anyway, I would say that given Chris's drinking life, probably not quite the same plans as us. So that's what Chris was paying attention to. Okay. And he was not as in on like the Sam Darnold discourse throughout the entire offseason in the same way. And I was like, if you are complaining to me about Sam Darnold, you have come to the wrong place, right? Because I am the most preachingness of Sam Darnold that there could possibly be at this point.
I'm trying to figure out what the right joke is here. You're the gospel of Sam Darnold.
And so he was making some of these throws throughout the game, right? Like the pass to JSN, just boom, dot, perfect throw. AJ Barner down the seam, bam, perfect, right? The fade to Torrey Horton, beautiful. And Chris, I was like, are you Sam Darnold pilled yet? And Chris was like, I need one more throw. And then he lobs up a 45-yard pass to JSN. And I was like, are you now? Are you now on Sam Darnold? Because any of those people who are like, the Seahawks can't win a Super Bowl with Sam Darnold. I might have even been one of those people. I've been the most extremely in on Darnold that there is, and I still might have even been that way. Sam Darnold can win a Super Bowl, and Sam Darnold...
You were going to say will?
That was a joke. But like, there's nothing holding...
Is that the choice between like the red pill and the action green pill when you get Sam Darnold pilled?
The only thing that is holding this team back... is probably, I think the offensive line is going to figure it out. They have to find a way to be able to run the ball better than they are right now. And
yeah,
especially I'm now we're at the phase of, it's crazy how badly they run the ball, given how good Sam Darnold is.
we are really,
but Helwani and Ken Walker, I mean, like now. They were basically like, apples to apples, you know, as far as I would assume success rate, yards per carry. Nobody did good there. And so that makes me think this is an offensive line issue. This is not a Ken Walker issue. Ken Walker didn't do anything. Like, there have been times in his career that Ken Walker was not running the right way. He wasn't hitting the holes. That didn't happen in this game, as far as I could tell. There just weren't holes. Things were closing too quickly for him. Against a Saints defense like that, like, it's going to be a thing. We might be number one in DVOA. We might have the banner up right now, but things are not perfect. This is not the Seattle Mariners with the perfect roster. There's something still to figure out for the Seahawks team, which is good. It's good to have room to improve after 3 weeks.
That's a way to put it.
Was there anything else from the TV broadcast that I would have missed?
We don't need to go into it.
But... Not that. No, I mean, like, literally not, like, complaining about the broadcasters. But we could do that every week. Except when it's Greg Olson.
The Chaz Surratt highlights. He got shouted out on SportsCenter tonight for the block on the Torrey Horton punt return.
It was, I think the block was beautiful, but then the celebrating, like, as he could see it, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, Chaz Surratt just seeing the future is such a beautiful thing.
Oh, huge pickup thus far. All right, let's talk about the health at the end of Thursday. So the Seahawks did not practice, obviously, on Monday, but had to issue a report as if they did. Zach Charbonnet, who missed this game, was listed as full participation in the estimated practice report. Eamon Worry, Love, Witherspoon, all limited. And then Robbie Oots, who came out of this with an ankle injury, as did Josh Jones, both did not practice. So seeming unlikely, probably, that we're going to see those two guys on Thursday night against the Cardinals. But, you know, if they can get some of the secondary back, I think that would be very exciting, as well as their fill-ins have played thus far. All right, let's talk about the Cardinals. Oh, no, actually, one other note. Mike Garofolo of NFL Network reported Monday that the Seahawks will sign veteran Khalil Herbert to the practice squad to add some running back depth. He's age 27, spent his first 3.5 seasons with the Bears before being traded to the Bengals for a 7th-round pick last November. Signed with the Colts for the minimum in free agency, was waived during roster cutdowns.
Definitely drafted him in fantasy at least 2 times.
That sounds about right. Damian Martinez pretty clearly does not factor in the Seahawks' plans at running back at this point. So
yeah, where does Khalil Herbert, where is he slotting in here? Like, is this just protection for Sharp, or you don't sign Khalil Herbert without planning on probably having him be active at some point?
You would think, yeah. I don't know, it'll be interesting. Me, but an indication probably that George Helani has not locked down that third running back job as much as we hoped he had based on his preseason.
I thought yesterday heading in that game, I was like, we're going to lead this game and be like, George Helani's better than Ken Walker and Zach Charbonnet, and that is not what happened.
We left the game thinking that offensive line determines running back success. Weird.
Did I say that in the Husky section, by the way? About how much they were glazing the Husky offensive line the entire Apple Cup? When has that ever happened?
I think it happened. I don't... Like, about the ago, Husky actually, offensive line,
the line was actually quite great, but
they did literally win the, I forget what the award is, for best offensive line.
It was just like, I can't believe how 180 it was on that line. I was like, that is 900 pounds of Trump voter right there, blocking between the Hatchett brothers and Josh Mills. It's a good line.
Not all offensive linemen. All right, the Seahawks opened as underdogs at Arizona, but Lions now generally have them as slight favorites in this game. The Cardinals won 8 games last year under Jonathan Gannon. That matched their total from the previous 2 seasons combined, including Gannon's first year as head coach. Actually had the best point differential in the NFC West last season at plus 21. I did not remember that. This was their first 2-0 start since they began 7-0 en route to an 11-6 finish in 2020-21. I was preparing to edit that on Sunday to their first 3-0 start since then, once they got the go-ahead safety in the fourth quarter at San Francisco. But they then allowed Mac Jones to drive for the winning field goal in a two-minute drill situation in a game, and ended up losing this one 16-15 in a game where Kyler Murray passed for just 159 yards. Murray is averaging a career low 9 yards per completion without any uptick in terms of his completion percentage. And the Carolina game is the only time he's beaten 5.6 yards per attempt in a game this season. And then on the other hand, that said one thing. And then the Cardinals are 10th in EPA per play on dropback so far. Some combination of scrambles. They've had a couple of big pass interference plays. Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin pointed out when I asked about this. And then Murray has avoided negative plays. He has just 1 interception, 0 fumbles thus far. Tight end Trey McBride, coming off his first Pro Bowl appearance, remains their top receiving threat. Marvin Harrison Jr. targeted just 17 times in three games. His yards per target is up from 7.6 as a rookie, which wasn't bad, to 8.4 this season. Similar to Ohio State, though, no other non-running back has been targeted more than eight times or has more than four catches this season. So not a lot going on in the Arizona passing game, and what is going on is entirely concentrated on Trey McBride and Marvin Harrison Jr. The Cardinals are 30th in rush EPA per play. Their veteran starter, James Conner, was carted off Sunday with what Adam Schefter reported is an ankle injury that will require season-ending surgery. After he went out, 2024 third-round pick Trey Benson took over and kind of outperformed him, frankly. Cardinals are 13th in defensive DVOA. They are 14th against the pass in terms of EPA per play. Very stout against the run, so this is going to be another tough test for that Seahawks run office. They're 6th in terms of EPA per play in opponents rushing a couple of spots behind the Seahawks, who are 4th there. And this was exciting to see on Sunday, because I missed this during the offseason, that Calais Campbell is back where he started, very appropriately so, and still tied for the team lead with 2 sacks. So there you go. The Arizona Cardinals, I got to say, I just summing it up, their advanced stats are not bad. I guess I didn't put where their DVOA is, but I think they're about 15th overall. They're basically an average team.
There was a lot of groundswell around the Cardinals this offseason, especially around over-under time. And I just kind of felt, I might have said this on the podcast, it was a little bit of like, what happened? And I think maybe it was the point differential last season and people just being like, well, we don't know for these four teams, so maybe let's just pick that one with the best point differential. But the Kyler performance so far, like, I think Kyler might be entering the territory of, he just, you know, he's 28 now. Like, maybe Kyler is going to become a different quarterback, but he just kind of is who we thought he was. And the not getting the ball downfield is definitely not a great situation for playing the Seahawks team. I don't see how the Cardinals are going to score points here.
This offense just feels kind of fraudulent. It feels House of Cards to me.
It's House of Cards, but they're not even scoring that many points.
Yes. It's House of Cards in terms of the, you know, the DVOA and the EPA per play.
I mean, it's 20 against the Saints, 27 against the Panthers, and 15 against the Niners. So I just, like, looking at that schedule, and granted the Niners are a fairly good team and they're on the road, but I feel like this one is setting up pretty nicely for the Seahawks right now. And I'm not sure. I mean, are they going to score more than 15 points, 17 points in this game? Be pretty surprised by that.
Yeah, I think 17 is probably the right number. My one concern here is the Seahawks are going to have the everyone believes in us week, especially after being number one in DVOA.
Let me rephrase that, though. Okay. They're going to have a prove it week right now.
I hope that's it.
Because it could go either way. I see what you're saying. People, how about, like, the Carolina Panthers are going to have, maybe not an everyone believes in us week, but like,
I don't think everyone believes in the Carolina Panthers yet. I mean, maybe the Indianapolis Colts.
There are teams that, where are the Colts? Are they number two in DVOA?
Oh, they are number two. They're far ahead of the field, Seahawks and Colts.
That is incredible. Here's what I'll say is that the Colts quarterback wasn't 14-3 last year.
That's true.
This offense was quite primed for a situation like this, with and the play action has been okay.
No, it's are been we, more are, than okay. It's been
we're happy.
We've reached average for the season, and it's three games, and one of those games was terrible.
Yeah, okay.
So they've been solidly good the last 2 weeks, and a lot of the big plays, especially early on Sunday, were out of play action, which, weirdly, they hadn't established the run. It's almost like you don't need to establish the run
who
to call play action.
I
don't know. I don't know.
The guy who's sitting two seats over from me at the game? Is that
maybe
who you're telling it to?
Maybe someone listening to the Pelton cast for the first time. They've come here for our analysis of the Storm's coaching search. And
my
and
other
learning.
Favorite thing that happens at the game is there's a big Canadian guy next to me. He was great. We really liked him a lot. And they sat down. I heard he was from Canada. We were chatting. He's from Chilliwack, if you want to know. Not far from Abbotsford.
I visited Chilliwack over the summer. That's where I broke my thumb.
How was it? Lovely?
It was other than the breaking my thumb, which I really can't blame Chilliwack for.
Absolutely.
It was lovely. I enjoyed it immensely.
It was like big Canadian guy. He was a big air drumming guy.
And I don't really remember going to the annual air show in Abbotsford as a child, but I have a distinct memory of that being something that we've done.
That's good to know. Well, he loved all the Rage Against the Machine and Disturbed or whatever was playing, and was doing a lot of AC/DC, a lot of air drumming to it. Two Canadian friends next to him. We left with, like, I don't know, 6 minutes left in the game or something like that. And the people were like, oh, you're leaving already? No, please don't go. And I was like, we literally had not spoken a word to these Canadians. That is how friendly Canadians are. I was like, I'm happy that we, like, the big dude we talked to, but his two friends, literally not a word. And that we made such an impression upon them. But Canadians, great experience. Anyway, that guy was delivering. He was like, who is that? Who's this doing this? I was like, that's Tory Horton. He was like, oh, he's a rookie, huh? And I'm like, sure is. Sure is.
Anyways, I do have this vague concern that everyone gets super excited about the Seahawks all week. And because of the fact that they're playing on national TV in a primetime game, and then they come out and play a 6-6 tie.
I'm more of the mind of they're number one in DVOA and they're playing the Cardinals and they're obviously going to win this game.
Well, continuing the theme of this podcast where, I mean, the storm season is over, so I have nothing to be more confident about now.
It's not even more confident. I love that you're the, like, but it's a trap game. That's your argument?
I mean, it's not like statistically the Seahawks should be overwhelming favorites in this game.
I'm not saying that necessarily, but, like, they're clearly the better team right now. They have the best point differential in the entire NFC. And granted, they also play the Saints. So you can't just be like, well, the Seahawks play the Saints, because they did too. We played a harder record than the Arizona Cardinals have played. Probably. I don't know. Maybe the Panthers are good. I like them.
I mean, two of the three teams are in common. The Steelers did win on Sunday, correct? So the Seahawks' strength of schedule is higher than Arizona's.
Because the Steelers are 2-1. Yeah.
So the sample size is not super large. But yes, the argument for the Cardinals cannot be the Seahawks have played an easy schedule when two of the three opponents are common. Yeah,
maybe that being home versus road for the Saints was worth an additional 24 points, but
I think the Seahawks are the better team. I think they are likely to win. I'm just a little wary. That's just what I'm telling.
I get it. I understand. You be wary. I do love that you, as statistician of this podcast, is the one who's like, but people are going to be saying how good they are.
I've been there.
Fair enough. I don't know if I have, though. Have you actually been there? Because this is a Seahawks team. You're giving me the look of how dare I question whether you've been there.
Yeah.
When was the last time, like, you're like harkening back to, like, same old Seahawks days? You're talking about, like, Mike Holmgren era right now.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the distinct memory that is popping into my head right now. I don't know.
I mean, I remember the 6-6 tie. Don't think I don't remember that, but that was a different team.
Okay, the Seahawks started 2-0 in 2019. People are feeling good about that. They're hosting the New Orleans Saints, who were starting their backup quarterback, who was Teddy Bridgewater.
I remember that, yeah. I remember that game.
This was the last time I watched a Seahawks game in LA, which I will be in LA for this game. And they lose 33-27 at home. And I was there watching it with Mina, third Pelton brother Mina, Kimes. And Danny Dimes was debuting.
You have to go, you're like, there. Mina, I'm friends with Mina. Mina Kimes. I like that everybody knows who the fuck Mina is.
You know, look.
Kimes,
again,
if you've heard her, actually.
Maybe the...
Yeah, oh, she's my coworker. Nah, it's fine. Mina Kimes was the one.
Maybe the guy from Chilliwack is listening.
Was it Mina Savari?
Wow, that's a name I've not heard in a long time. Anyways, but you have this long track record of watching Seahawks victories in foreign cities and then calling in to pod emergency.
I don't know if I have that long of a track record. I think I did watch on a plane that, like, score on the game cast. I was trying to watch the stream of it when the Ravens and Mike McDonald's defense absolutely just
That was the last time I was in LA for a Seahawks game, wasn't it? No, actually, I mean, I was there last year too. There was probably a Seahawks game. It's been a I don't know if they won last year.
Yeah, I'm so distracted by brunch with Mina. Whoever can remember the games.
No, that game I remember.
I was just like, why am I even paying attention to this? Like,
they beat the Jets last year when I was in LA. Wow, this stat is untrue.
I like that you called it a stat. The stat of remembering when you were in LA while a game was happening in Arizona. Okay, how about this? When was the last time the Seahawks lost at Arizona?
Oh, that has been a great place for them.
I know that they lost during the COVID year because that was the one where there was the Buddha chased down, or DK chased down Buddha, and then right. We lost because of a bullshit penalty.
I believe that was the last one. And you also have to wait. And I guess that was the year they beat the Niners in Arizona. So that was the start of their winning streak at State Farm Stadium, which is currently at 4 games.
Okay, so they have not lost since then.
No.
Kyler just has never really, Kyler brings no fear to me. And not that I'm saying Kyler brings fear to almost anybody, but like, he just hasn't ever really done anything against us.
It's all fair.
So, I don't know. Maybe there's something about this particular defense that Kyler just is worse with. And then also just owning Marvin Harrison Jr. in both fantasy leagues. I am keenly aware of how Marvin Harrison Jr. has been playing. It's just like, yeah, when you see the RBSDM EPA plus CPOE composite, and you're like, of course, Jared Goff, clearly the best quarterback in the NFL. We can all agree. And then, Darnold? Wait. Why am I not seeing? Oh, okay, there is number 5. Yeah, Darnold at number 5. You're like, you've got all your best quarterbacks, Goff, Lamar, Josh Allen, Sam Darnold. And then Kyler is just his entire career been kind of like he's in the group. He's never an outlier on the wrong side. He's never in JJ McCarthy territory, but like Kyler's kind of like right there. He's in the like they're good quarterbacks. You can't win a Super Bowl with Kyler Murray. He's no Sam Darnold, but like, you know, he's good.
Percentage chances of victory.
68%.
55%.
55? You know we're going to win this shit. Come on. Every time I say that, we lose, though.
No, who's doing analytics? On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Spencer Rattler's not bad by EPA plus CPOE.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't actually terrible. Like Spencer Rattler wasn't the problem on Sunday.
There were some throws that Spencer Rattler where I was like, wow, I wish they had Damon Williams as their quarterback.
All right. Who doesn't?
We all wish we had Damon Williams as our quarterback. Even when we have him. But there were some throws where I was like, man, Spencer Rattler missed the throw. I thought it was kind of notable that I guess Drake May's having a pretty good year. But it is just like the same thing as last year. I was like, old quarterbacks. Not old. Like, I want to be the team that has Bryce Young next.
Yes.
Because I've just like never been more convinced that Bryce Young is going to be good eventually.
Are you intending for me to make this the after the pod?
I don't know. I don't know if we'd find ourselves in good conversation or not.
Your definition of when we find ourselves in good conversation is broader than most people's.
I like when we're talking to each other and we can't talk about anything because we have to save it for the pod.
It does make conversations challenging. It's why it was much easier when we were feuding, ironically. Yeah, no, that's
a good point. You really love bringing up this feuding. This should happen like 10 years ago.
Pepperidge Farm remembers. The North remembers.
It's just crazy how comfortable I am with a winning. This weekend, it was like Luca's team went out there. It started, Friday, the Savannah Bananas won.
Oh, wow.
That was actually the only game that I lost all weekend because I was cheering for the Firefighters.
It's kind of the Firefighters seem very popular. Shouldn't you pick someone unpopular to be playing against?
No, they want to build up all the other teams.
I see. How many other teams are there?
Three.
Okay. Who are the, what are the other two teams besides the firefighters?
There's the firefighters and the party animals, and I don't know.
Oh, okay. This it is amazing. Like, this was the Seattle Sports Weekend, as we've just discussed, and yet the single biggest thing on social media, like Top Pot did social, did banana stuff. Marination had banana filled malasadas, that because they're actually in the stadium. That one made was it completely logical. I don't know if you said Treat did a Savannah Bananas.
Did anything further come of that? The Treat thing.
I didn't see anything, but I guess we'll find out.
I do have
the is so the head of the Savannah Bananas, he's on a search for the nation's best chocolate chip cookie. Is that what's going on here?
I don't know anything about this. The amount that I actually know about the Savannah Bananas is like quite low, but and I would say it was like a thing that we had to do for the children. You know what I mean? Like, it's like it was like an important event in children world.
Yes.
I mean, that would be awesome if I was him and able to travel around the country and just have people delivering me the best chocolate chip cookies. How great would that be?
Can't complain.
But my scene report from Savannah Bananas was there are some aspects of it that are very Savannah, Georgia. And some of the things that they do where I was like, I'm not going to go further on this because this more like not polite company conversation. But there are some things where I was like, that's a little Savannah, Georgia for Seattle, Washington. And then there are some things that they do where I'm like, I'm impressed with their ability to be national at this. I will tell you, it is notable that that team is called the Firefighters.
Yeah.
Because there are other things that the team could have been called that it makes a little bit more sense. Nobody dislikes firefighters. You know what I mean?
100% uncontroversial.
Our nation's heroes. And then they did like during the game or like the dancers, they have the, I don't know, the man nanas or whatever. And they're just like big fat dudes who dance. And I'm like, no notes. Genius. You know what I mean? That's how they approach having like cheerleaders and stuff. I'm like, great. Phenomenal job. They did a like thank you to, like, they were like people who are in armed services, like stand up and be recognized. And then they did like a thank you to everybody who works in like different professions or whatever. And it was like firefighters, EMTs, police officers, school teachers, doctors, nurses. It was like they went so deep on things that you literally could not complain about it.
Did they get to music managers?
Not yet. I will tell you, school teachers got the biggest ovation.
Oh, good for them. What about sports writers?
Did sports they writers.
Up? What did someone think of the sports writers?
Probably not for ESPN on Friday. But they did not get to music managers. But no, it was sort of like they just recognized everybody. And you're like, well, I can't complain about them recognizing somebody if they recognized everybody.
Exactly.
So I think they did a pretty good job. But on the scale, which I didn't know was a scale of circus to baseball, it's a little bit closer to the circus side.
I didn't have a good sense of this until there was like one day there was nothing on and I was just sitting in front of the TV and I put on like the pregame show and and learned a lot from that. Where,
but like, they're good
at
baseball.
Closer. I thought it was more like, you know, like dancing in between the innings or that sort of things. I didn't realize it was as far in the circus scale, or I don't know, is this a Globetrotters to basketball scale? That
see,
could also be a scale.
People compare it to the Globetrotters, but the Globetrotters are good at basketball also. But like the point of the Globetrotters is that like the games are rigged for the Globetrotters.
How dare you?
And this is, they just like play, like everybody is trying their hardest. My favorite part of the whole experience is when there's just a normal baseball play. When they're just like, it's like 6-3 ground out.
You're the only one who's there like, no, oh man.
It's just hilarious because it is so loud in there, and like there's like a lot of trick plays, but sometimes they're just like, I can't catch that ball behind my back, I'm just gonna make a solid routine play.
and you're the one person up there clapping.
And I'm like, yes, fundamentals. But like they are all very good at baseball and they're playing a real baseball game. Like there's different rules to it, but like it's not. And so the crazy thing that happened, so they bring out Jamie Moyer. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see about this from.
They brought out
Fantasy
the big
Genius
maple the next night, which I was
oh,
like,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They brought out the guy from Train to sing "Hey Soul north? Sister." The Big Maple came up north. Yes, he's. I don't. He's not from Vancouver, is he?
I believe he's from Toronto, isn't he? I don't know.
The other part that I loved was so the two people that they brought out Walt Jones for like a like thing. Not he wasn't playing baseball. The Mariners bullpen catcher, who is like a prospect for the Mariners, and he came out. There were two outs, and there's like the guy who steals bases was on first. Gets gunned down. He gets caught stealing because that's what I'm saying. It's like real baseball. He got caught stealing. There was a review. He was out. Like the dude. So the dude didn't get to hit the bullpen catcher guy who was hitting that moment. And I was like, you got to let like this is the most important moment for this bullpen catcher that has ever happened, right? He's hitting in front of 47,000 people at T-Mobile Park right now for a bullpen catcher that is massive. Then he goes and plays defense at first, comes back up, and then he's like popped out to begin the next inning or something. But I was like, this dude needs to hit. We have to let him hit. So I thought that was kind of cool. Like, there are some cool things, but like the, like Jamie Moyer like came out and pitched to a batter and it was like, that's pretty fun, right? Jamie Moyer? I'm nostalgic for him.
Yeah.
I think people had like more wilder dreams of who
the weird
come.
Thing about Jamie Moyer is he pitched for the Mariners so long that he transcends both the period that you are nostalgic about and the period that you are anti in Mariners history.
I mean, I would have been fine with like, I like James Paxton too, but if I don't know who the pitcher would have been during that time period, like the early 2000s that I didn't pay attention to, because most of the pitchers were kind of like both sides of it.
Yes, it's hard to think of someone who is, I mean, Aaron Seeley.
Aaron Seeley is like the only one, but I did care about when the Mariners signed. I remember when they signed Aaron Seeley and I was excited about it.
Sadly, James Paxton is from Richmond, BC. So
there we go.
He came south.
He came south. Yes, but like James Paxton, I was like, yeah, that's fun, right? I like him.
The only way that we can get tourists down from British Columbia at this point is to have them participate in this party.
But and then there was like, so that was fun. Like, again, the whole experience was fun. It is very loud. I will never be attending another game. It also was a little bit more minor league baseball than I thought, because that's basically where it starts, right? And I was thinking about Casey Catherwood, who is like the Rainiers in-game person. I guess he did the Tacoma Stars too, which I didn't know. But I was like, he had the bow tie, and there's a certain attitude, a minor league baseball announcer attitude, which is like a little dry, you know, like you joke around with the kids, you have like wink, wink. It's almost like Pixar, but like a little bit drier, and you have the jokes for adults and for kids or whatever. And so they still do a lot of the like minor league baseball stuff that's kind of like deeply baked into what they do. And I was like, the problem with Casey was that like being with the Rainiers, you're too indebted to the baseball. You can't like go as extreme as they were able to do with the Bananas and just have it be like all fun. But so like after the game, literally they have a 2-hour clock up. Very nice. Cause then you could be like, okay, that's exactly how long it is until I can go home. Great. I wish everything had a clock up of when you get to go home. But after Keely and I were like, why was this boring? And like somehow, even though it's just like constant noise, bells, whistles, everything, we were both like, that was like kind of weirdly boring. And it's because the emotional investment in the thing happening, like you could go see like greatest players in the world. And it's like, I could be so bored by that. If you don't have an emotional investment in it and you're not invested, like, I don't care about the stories of these players. You know what I mean? They're just kind of some guys who are barnstorming, and that's nice. But like,
Noah Cohen's loving that it's all story.
I mean, we know that's what it is. It's just the success helps you tell the story. It's like the two things are linked to each other, but like being successful helps you tell a good story. It's the same way like music, like we don't like songs, you know what I mean? Like you like songs are all that matters, but then a good song, you tell the story of the good song, and then it takes on new meaning beyond that. So it was just like, I can't believe that I am like so fucking bored at this thing that is like literally just designed to entertain the entire time. And maybe I'm dead on the inside.
You're also not a child. Aaron Seeley, if you want to tell the story, maybe the most famous person from Poulsbo, unless there's someone not listed on their Wikipedia page.
Oh, man.
So there you go.
It's really the notion of the RV is more famous than. Don't you think? At least around here.
If they're building a statue, it's going to be of an RV.
Every, like, literally when you hear the word Poulsbo, do you not just think of RV?
I don't think that's I having now been to Polsbo twice this year. That is not the first thing I think of.
I went to Polsbo. It's fine. Made up it's a lovely Taco Bell there, not a Taco Time. I don't know if they have a Taco Time.
Well, I went to the Taco Time on the way to Polsbo. I'm not sure what the technical location is, though.
So all we did the Savannah Bananas.
Yeah.
Luca won both of his games, shoved. The Huskies won. Marco won his race on Saturday. The Seahawks won. I don't know if you knew.
I did.
Then the Mariners
we talked,
after
we just
that,
talked about it.
And I was like, winning is so exhausting for the MVP.
Oh my God. Well, what happened? Did your fantasy team win?
No. I mean, I'm Lamar. I literally have paid like no attention to this Monday night game, but Lamar is going to have to do some things.
Did just throw a touchdown as we're recording.
And Nick Bosa's out for the year with an ACL tear. I just keep winning.
You're going to
get
tired.
8 of 9, 98 yards and a touchdown.
Tired of winning. On that note,
thanks for listening. Ooh,
thanks.
11 carries for 19 yards.